It's time for TWiNT This Week in Tech. Great panel. Mike Elgin is here. He's in Mexico City, all the way from a pineapple under D.C. It's Shoshana Weissman from R Street. And my favorite, Christina Warren from GitHub. She's sitting right next to me. Is an executive order on AI a good idea or a bad idea? We'll talk about Amazon's Project Nessie, designed to keep prices high. And then it's the end of the line for Mint. We'll say goodbye. All that and more coming up next on TWiT.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is TWiT. This Week in Tech, episode 952, recorded Sunday, November 5th, 2023. A gathering of the protons. This episode of This Week in Tech is brought to you by ExpressVPN. Secure your family's online activity and unlock hundreds of new shows by visiting expressvpn.com/TWiT. Take back your online privacy today and use my link to get 3 extra months free with a 1-year package. And by Collide. Collide is a device trust solution for companies with Okta. Collide ensures if a device isn't trusted and secure, it can't log into your cloud apps. Visit collide.com/TWiT to book an on-demand demo today. It's time for TWiT This Week in Tech, the show where we cover the week's tech news. Love this panel. I say that every week, but this week I mean it. Shoshana Weissman is here. She is, of course, the chair of the Sloth Committee, but maybe more interested in her day job, head of digital media at rstreet.org. Hello, Senator Shoshana.
Hey, thank you so much for having me.
I see you've moved in back into your pineapple under D.C. It's hard to give
that
up.
Yeah, my husband, you know.
SpongeBob?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. He couldn't take it away from home.
He and I are just really close, and you know.
Nothing more to say. To your right, Shoshana, say hello to Christina Warren from GitHub. She's in town because yes. The GitHub universe is in town.
That's right. That's right. And so you were kind enough to be able to let me come in studio this week. I'm so glad.
Oh, we love having
here.
You. In.
Yeah.
And I should have brought my name tag from last year's
I know.
GitHub universe.
Yeah, which was great. Which we're still doing things like that. There have been some, like you can still program that and do cool things with the badge. It's so fun.
Is there like firmware I can update?
Yeah, I mean, well, so technically, yeah. I mean, like we just were using, I think, some of the base level stuff. But that's what's neat about it is that people do update and add things to those RPi zeros all the time.
Yeah, it was an RPi zero. Yeah. Name tag, yes. So you could program it with your name and your company,
and you could do some other things with it too. Like it would even show like your you know Git commit you know activity and
yeah.
things
How
like
many
that.
Stars you have
exactly.
Unfortunately, I haven't used mine since last year.
That's okay.
I'm gonna have to. I should have brought it. Wasn't even thinking.
That's okay. Find it and like it'll just be like a fun project
yeah.
to just you know. Bring out when you're yeah. out when you're back from your retreat and you're allowed to have access to a computer again.
Oh, you I should can wear that badge on the retreat and see if they beat me. I was telling everybody that I'm going on a electronics free retreat November 25th. I'll be gone for a week. No computer, no phones, no AirPods, no music. I can't even bring my Apple Watch. I have to get a Timex. It is that I'm going to be. But that's why I'm doing it, right?
Yeah.
See if I can.
See if you can do it. I mean,
cold turkey it.
I mean, genuinely, that is something that I would like to do to myself. I think I'd be miserable, but it's one of those things I would like to try.
I'll send you the info.
Yes, send me the info.
Digital detox. Nobody should have to do this. And all the way from the largest city in the north in the Americas, I don't know, is it in the
yes,
western?
Yes, largest in the Americas.
In the Americas.
Yeah, there are bigger cities in Asia, but
China.
Yeah. Mexico
yeah.
City.
Yeah.
Yes.
Woo!
And I got an idea. I think we should have a betting pool in Club TWiT. For how many days you can last without electronics.
That's a really good idea.
Yeah.
Mike Elgin
I'm going to think maybe
the
one.
Cynic. Well, you know, it's funny because Lisa went a couple of weeks ago, actually. And I'm watching Saturday, the first day. Oh, she's still there. Sunday, I'm thinking if she makes it through Sunday night, then she's going to do it. But I had the same thing. Like, really? But no, she loved it. So we're going to both detox.
Yeah.
And then we're going to ride off into the sunset.
I'm going to live the experience through you, Leo. I would
no,
never do such
nobody
a thing.
Would ever want that. Well, how would you go to sleep? What would you do when you wake up at 3 a.m? How do you doom scroll if you don't have a...
I mean, I guess you just have to be alone with your thoughts, which might actually be more frightening.
I think that's the point. No. I hate to say it, but I think that's the point. And what a terrible idea. So Mike Elgin has been going around Oaxaca.
Yes.
Wearing his Meta glasses. So show me. Do you have them with you? These are the new Ray-Ban, the second editions.
Yeah.
Oh, and they look just like regular spectacles. Is there a light that's on when you're recording?
Yes, there's a light that that goes on. I can demo these. Hang on, let me switch glasses here. So nobody could tell anything when I was doing this. So I basically say, "Hey Meta, take a picture," and then
it did. I heard a little sound.
And if I press and hold this little button, it pulses when you're doing a video.
Yeah.
And you can preset it to be a 15-second, 30- or 60-second video, and then it stops by itself, or it stops if you push the button. But the surprising thing is that it's got a voice assistant, like Siri. It's really good. I mean, really, really good.
Is it called Jarvis?
No. No, it's...
That's Mark Zuckerberg's personal assistant.
Exactly.
May I show... Oh, he's talking to you. Sure. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I didn't interrupt. May I show the video? I think it's on your Facebook, actually. It's not on your Insta.
Sure. Absolutely. Please do.
Okay.
I have a gazillion pictures. I was there for a Day of the Dead and just walking around taking pictures of the street scene and all that. It was really great.
Let me see if I can find it.
But yeah,
we were there 2 years ago with you guys for the Day of the Dead. It was incredible. What an experience.
Visually, it's really something.
And it was nice because you let me keep my smartphone. I was really, really
that's right.
pleased.
I wanted to ban all electronics, but
no.
It's, but these are, so just to put it in perspective, Google Glass, which I was a glasshole back in the day, 10 years ago or something, cost $1,500 and these cost $300. And the camera is vastly superior.
It's just a decent looking camera. This is Amira, your wife, walking downtown. Yeah. Oh, I recognize the street in Oaxaca.
That's really good.
And it's Day of the Dead,
it's
so everybody's
portrait mode,
made up. Yeah.
Optimized for Instagram. And you can live stream to Facebook and Instagram, which is really interesting.
That's really cool.
It's a little bobbly. Like you're walking around. I can see it's got some stabilization, but it's a little wobbly.
I mean, these are coming from his sunglasses,
absolutely.
Though.
No, like, I understand,
I get you. Yeah.
It's a first-person experience.
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I did, I didn't post the pictures yet, but I made pizza before we went to Oaxaca, and I was just like tossing the dough and like I was timing it so that it would take a picture of the dough in midair when I was like spinning it and all that stuff. And that kind of thing is pretty cool. Because, of course, you can't use your hand.
This is horrible. There's a child.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's Day of the Dead for you. There's children laying in the street acting like they're dead.
It's kind of a... But, you know, I like the Day of the Dead because it is this kind of embrace your morbidity thing.
Right.
And exactly. Unlike Halloween, it's like right in your face. Mm-hmm. It's not like, oh, spooky, spooky. No. It's like you're going to die.
And I'll take these off in a second. But
yeah, let me see some
exactly.
more. You look cool in them. Well, you don't look uncool.
They look just like Ray-Bans.
Yeah, exactly. But I was surprised by the quality of the assistant. I was asking it, how do you say stuff in Spanish? And it was just telling me immediately.
And you could use that immediately?
It was really, really great. And
should I buy some of these? $329.
Oh, yes. Bucks. Absolutely, you should buy them.
No, prescription lenses.
Here's my counter argument.
Yeah.
A normal pair of Wayfarers.
Tell me why.
A normal pair of Wayfarers is like $198.
Yes.
So you're talking about $100
that's
more.
That's not so bad.
That's what I'm saying.
Oh, you're telling me to buy them?
I am. I'm going to buy them.
Shoshana, help me.
I know. I'm going to get a Garmin smartwatch just so I can see my altitude when I'm hiking. But beyond that, I'm trying not to become a full robot, like just yet. You
fair,
know?
Fair.
Wouldn't you like to wear these, though, on your next hike? You take amazing pictures of these beautiful venues you're hiking in. And
oh, thank you. No, I hate wearing, I actually can't wear glasses or gloves very easily. I hate they get in the way of me doing stuff.
Fair.
I'm the only person on earth who has this problem, but I feel like a moron and I like trip over myself. So, but the fun thing is I have Raynaud's, which means my hands and feet go cold really fast. So I avoid wearing gloves until like they will not unfreeze. Then I'm like, fine, all right, I'll do it. So
maybe Meta will make some smart gloves for you and then you can... You can benefit.
Yeah. Here's the thing that people don't talk about with the glasses. Everybody talks about the camera. But it's really about the audio. The audio quality on the Ray-Ban Metas is very, very high. And the microphone quality, there are five microphones in it, is very, very good. But you can't wear AirPods all day.
Right.
You can have something in your ear all day, but you can wear glasses all day. And so
what's the battery life, though? You can't listen all day, can
If you're actively using it and using the camera and streaming and all that stuff, I think it's like 4 hours. It has a case that has a battery inside.
Oh,
so
okay.
The case has a battery life of 24 hours, something like that.
So you have the Wayfarers, which are the kind of the classic Jack Nicholson Ray-Ban style.
Exactly. And I have worn them at night, and I did look like Jack Nicholson.
Now, do you have the ones with the transition lenses, or do you have just like the regular polarized ones?
I polarized. I made the mistake of not getting those. And I probably am going to get a second pair that is clear.
And prescription is available, right? You can send them your prescription.
Yes. Right.
Which is probably what I would do, because I do wear glasses. I mean, I could wear them over my contacts, but I think I'd probably want to wear them as eyeglasses.
Yeah, but the power of just walking around and having audio ready to go, where you can just use the assistant, or you can hear your notifications, or you can have a phone conversation, and the audio quality is excellent, and have nothing in your ears. It's really kind of freedom. It like feels liberating to have nothing in your ears and still have good quality audio available. So I really like them.
No, I mean, that was the thing for me too. So I think I'm going to buy these. I think I'm going to get the transition lenses though, which are more expensive.
Oh my God, I thought you...
No, I thought
you
I was...
You were holding my hand to talk me out of it. Now,
No, not at all. Because the audio thing you pointed out. So I almost bought the Bose sunglasses with like the audio thing. I almost bought those a few times. Those were, again, not much less expensive. I didn't think they looked as good and didn't have the camera thing. So I don't know. For me, even if I only use the camera occasionally, the fact that it's a pair of Wayfarers, of which I have many, and
does it give you pause that Apple very much wants to be in this space and will probably do something with both AirPods and the Vision Pro next year?
I mean, by the time that happens, I mean, I've already bought the sunglasses, Leo. Like,
She's actually ordering them right now.
I am actually ordering them right now. I mean, well, because again, but you don't understand. I buy a lot of Ray-Bans. I usually lose them. No, I wasn't going to talk you out of it. I was going to say, I think it's actually, weirdly, I think that this is one of the... As I agree with Shoshana, I don't want to be a robot, but at the same time, I'm kind of like, you know what? I kind of...
Does it give anybody pause that this is meta?
Yes, but at the same time, meh, they have my information anyway.
You know, I recently rejoined Facebook, which I only did because I thought, well, it was when the war broke out in Israel, and I thought, well, I want to see what's going on with disinformation. I know it's a real problem. We got an election coming up. It's probably appropriate for me to be there. It is so far worse than anything I could remember. For one thing, my news feed is filled up with stuff that I didn't follow or subscribe or even, I don't know these people.
Right.
And it's mostly women in bikinis, which I don't understand why they're doing this to me.
Oh, come on.
Oh, I'm so sorry this is happening to you.
Well, somebody said, you know, you can stop that but you have to one by one block each account. And somehow, I mean, there's hundreds of these. Anyway,
I am back on Facebook,
so I could use this, right?
I recently rejoined Facebook as well, and I found it so bizarre.
It's so awful.
That I would basically want to go to follow somebody who was like my best friend in grade school.
Yeah.
And it said, you don't really know that person. And then it's always dangling this eye candy in front of me.
Constant candy.
And it's like, and it lets me follow those. So it's like, it feels like,
it's a straight ad feed. So I went past the one post I got from somebody I know to Elvis's old airplane being reconditioned to this is because I rejected all the bikini girls. So now they're going, oh man, maybe you're interested in woodworking. How would you like to fix your cabinets? There's somebody I know, NFL. They figure, well, if you're not interested in bikinis, here's some Marissa Tomei scanty. Oh, they're back. You can't get away from them.
Man, that one was really aggressive.
Look, I'm not a prude by any means.
Yeah.
But I'm offended that this is like what they put in my feed. Like, this is terrible. Look at this. Yeah. Babes in bikinis and ladies in lingerie. You know what? I don't want to snooze it. I want to hide it. But now, I guess I should report it. But obviously nobody's reporting these things, right?
Well, Twitter's kind of the same right now. Like how, like people will like randomly like your posts, and it's, you know, it's bots, and it's all this, it's like,
it's bots.
10 Hannahs.
But how do they know me? How do they, thought I was private on Facebook. No.
Yeah, on Facebook, it's weirder.
It's so creepy. It's really creepy.
It's one of the, you know, actually it's one of the great things about the Meta glasses. It's, doesn't have a screen. There's no algorithmic element to it at all. And you can do a lot of information gathering just through voice without ever looking at a screen. So it's kind of for small things, everyday things, like who was that actress in that movie that I don't remember her name?
You can, for that sort but of that's thing. What I use Google or Echo for, right? That's,
yeah.
It's the same kind of thing, mm-hmm. except it's always on. And but you know what? We can use our AirPods to do that.
Yeah.
Do you ever go, hey, Shlomo, you know, who was that actress?
I mean, I think if Shlomo worked better, I would.
Yeah,
sure.
Maybe that's the problem.
Because genuinely, we are very close to actually having, you know, like the Star Trek communicator, like translator thing working. Yep. And the AI stuff is there. It's just not in our smart devices yet.
Well, Meta said that next year they're going to add a feature to the Meta Ray-Ban glasses, Ray-Ban Meta glasses, where it will process visual information through AI. So you'll be looking at something and say, what is this? And it will tell you. Or
like
it'll
Google
say,
Lens, give me an, but always.
Yeah, exactly. Like, give me instructions for how to operate this machine, and it'll
so this,
tell
would you. I noticed audio. You're not wearing them full time. Would you make these your regular glasses?
Totally. Totally. The problem is they're sunglasses. And
so I'm going to get the clear transitions with my prescription.
Yeah.
I can look like Clark Kent all the time.
I love it.
Exactly. And then you whip them off and then you have your Superman outfit and people would not recognize
you. Do they have other styles?
Yeah, they do. They have different colors, different styles.
Yeah.
One thing I like about this, they've got a line of them where they're semi-transparent, like the original, like those old iMacs, like the Raspberry iMacs and stuff. So these are pretty cool, I think, where you can kind of see through them. They also have opaque materials.
So you say the mistake you made was not buying clear ones so that you could wear them all the time.
Right. Well, or transition lenses.
So they'd be sunglasses.
Both. Yeah, so but I'm actually thinking about getting clear ones and wearing them both. I have no reason to not wear them all the time. They're comfortable. I don't know. They're glasses.
Okay, so I want to try these on. You must allow access to your camera. Okay, so I'm going to try these on.
Oh, yeah. See, there you go.
These are the headliners.
I mean, not bad.
I look like Estelle.
There's the Jack Nicholson.
Yep.
That's not Jack Nicholson. That's Larry Bud Melman.
Yeah, there you go.
Hey, Dave. I don't want to give it. You already ordered them, or haven't you?
I haven't yet. I'm trying to figure out, like, when I'm going to, like, if I'm going to pick them up. Out of store
I do
in
like this try-on feature, though, I have to say.
Yeah.
This can you just nice keep way. This running for the rest of the show?
Yeah, let's do the whole show like this.
Yeah. Do they have heart-shaped?
Not... This is, you know, the
do
right stuff,
what?
1960s.
Heart-shaped? Do they have, like, heart-shaped?
No. The closest they have are these Estelle Parsons in teal blue. Let's see if I get
these. These are fun.
Yeah. Should I get these, Shoshana?
No, I think... Do they have, like, a square one? You need a square frame.
I know. My head's so round. I should have something that counters it.
I'm minus two, so I feel.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, let's face it. You're wearing glasses that are feeding everything you're seeing back to Meta. Do you worry about privacy? I guess it wouldn't, because that'd kill the battery and the bandwidth. Is it connected? It's connected to your phone.
It is connected to the phone. And I was actually surprised. I asked it last night. I was walking around Mexico City, and I wasn't sure what neighborhood I was in. And I asked the assistant what neighborhood I'm in. I'm sorry, we don't have access to your location information. I'm like, you're kidding. I actually wanted it to have location information on me. I don't know.
This is how they get you.
That's how they get you. So
it's funny. I've been thinking about, like, utility, because I'm insane and obsessed with hiking, but I've been thinking about hiking utility, and, like, every year I refresh my memory on, like, am I looking at a grizzly? Am I looking at a black bear? Like, AI glasses could be like, oh, the hump on the back. Like, we can analyze this bear in front of you. It's not going to eat you and stuff like that.
Hey, Meta, should I run or freeze?
Yeah. Should I run and play dead? Like, what's going on here?
If I ordered them now, I can have them by the 13th.
There you go.
Yeah. I got to get my prescription so I can. So it's a camera, and you can record stills and video. I was actually impressed. It's a decent camera. Is it 12? It's 12 megapixels.
Yep. The last one was 4 or 5, something like that.
That's a big difference. Do you get audio? Does it record audio?
I don't think it records just audio.
See, one of the things that would be useful. The other thing I've been looking at, I'm a complete idiot, is that pin, the humane pin.
Oh, yeah. Yes. Yeah,
that you wear.
That's interesting.
It may not be there yet, but the idea of the humane, among other things, the humane pin is it records all your audio. So, yeah. And then sends it to an AI. Oh, they're actually starting to show it now. Here's what it looks like.
Yeah, that looks like that.
It's like a little phone. It's got a magnetic backing so you can attach it to your lapel or your pants.
It looks like the Memento device from years ago.
It's the same idea, isn't
Memento
it?
Memento camera.
Because it'll record pictures of your day, but it also records audio. The thing I thought was most interesting, so for instance, it could record our conversation and then give me a synopsis, action items.
See, that's interesting.
In your business meetings, that would be useful.
Yeah, I mean, people have started to build things like that, I think, into like Slack and Microsoft Teams and stuff like that. And I think if everyone is aware that it's recording, I think that's a good idea.
And they say, now this is going to, they're going to, so the people behind this are Imran Chowdhury, who is a designer with 20 years at Apple. And then Bethany Bongiorno, who also is at Apple, as director of software engineering. So it's a pretty good pedigree. Mm-hmm. And they will be making the big announcement or the reveal. We're going to do it last month, and they've delayed it till the 9th.
And I think they're married or something. But what I want to see is, I don't know if you're familiar with a new, it's in beta, I think, product called Dot from New Computer.
I am very interested. Okay, now that we're talking, put this into the Meta glasses or the Humane pin.
Yes.
Now I'm really interested. I signed up for this too.
It's life logging, but like,
yeah,
like so they, doable.
It's, this is the example. This is from New Dot Computer. The example they give you is a young college student day before school. She's in kitchen. Her grandmother hands her a recipe. She says, take that. That way you'll never feel too far away from home, except that it's in Chinese. It's her flatbread, so she shares it. Now, see, if you had the humane pin, you just take a picture of the glasses. She uses her phone. It translates it and then adds the English language version of that recipe to her inventory, her memory.
And then 6 months later, when she says, what should I make for dinner? It'll say, how about your grandma's recipe?
Yeah. Same thing here. She fed it their syllabus, the syllabi from her classes. And then when she got to the bookstore, she said, I'm at the bookstore. What textbooks do I need? It was the AI. And this is something an AI can do.
Yeah.
Would say, these are the textbooks that the syllabi say you need to buy. That would be very handy.
This, yeah.
Yeah.
In like Homer Simpson recording hat form. I want to wear a big orange foam hat with this thing in it.
Oh, yeah. You need to buy some books.
But the killer app of this idea is that it's instead of doing prompt engineering, it prompts you. So it will just out of the blue say, hey, how about XYZ based on your context, based
or
on what it knows.
Or how you feeling today I saw you were in poli sci. Did you enjoy that class? So it's kind of giving you a chance to journal. I think it's very interesting. Now, this is under development. It will be an iOS and web app, they say, later this year, which isn't too far off. So right now, there's no pricing or anything or availability. But I did, of course, put myself on the wait list for that. But you're right. You need to combine these devices, don't you?
Yes. If it harvests its own data about your life and your preferences and what you do, is proactive at telling you things or suggesting things or giving you advice or telling you about stuff you didn't know about, that is going to be really great. And I think things like camera glasses are going to be key with that. It's augmented reality of the best kind without the holographic part of it. We've always thought of AR as being HoloLens or Magic Leap type holographic content. But I don't think we have the technology to do that cost affordably for many years. In the meantime, let's do it all with audio only, not the holograms, because that's the expensive part.
So there are a number of issues that immediately come to mind, and I know our audience is going, well, okay, fine. You are handing over all this life data to Meta or Dot or Humane.
Instead of just Amazon.
Well, I mean, I think there's some legitimate concern, especially now knowing we know about data brokers and so forth. So privacy is going to be really important for these to succeed. I think before people even adopt them, if you're going to be following me everywhere, I better. I mean, of course, we do it with our phones already, but I think people are going to be concerned about that. There's a second issue, which is that AI, we know, hallucinates. I hate to even use a personification like saying it hallucinates. It makes it's error prone,
right?
And now you're giving it some agency in your life. Are you giving it too much agency? Is it risky for you to do that? And then there's the third larger issue, which is subtler, which is what's going to happen to us? Like, we're pretty soon we're just going to be the vehicle that rolls this AI around from place to place. Initially, it'll be like, you know, like the movie Her, where we're just kind of giving our emotional life over to this machine. But sooner or later, it's going to feel like the machine is trumping the humanity. Is that unreasonable to worry about? Is that a sci-fi issue?
I don't know. I mean, it's actually interesting you brought up Her, because that film is now 10 years old.
And it's prescient.
I was going to say. And so actually my friend Simone de Rochefort and I are going to like rewatch it together.
I will watch that.
And then
stream that?
Yes, we're going to stream that and then like analyze it like in the lens of 10 years later.
Also from a female point of view.
Yes. Yeah, totally.
Because it's about a guy, Joaquin Phoenix, who puts in this AI that's in his ear and is very smart and is Scarlett Johansson's voice, which doesn't hurt, and falls in love with her.
Yeah. But it asks some very interesting questions about, to your point, like the nature of like what love is in relationships and
he has a better life, frankly, with her.
Yeah.
But then she leaves, which is really, I don't.
The whole thing was actually.
Go ahead.
Sorry, go on.
Christina, what was it all about?
I mean, the whole film was written so that the director, Spike Jonze, could get over his relationship with Sofia Coppola. And Rooney Mara was essentially the stand-in for the Sofia Coppola character. The interesting thing here, interesting/funny, is that the film that Sofia Coppola wrote to get over Spike Jonze, Lost in Translation, also stars Scarlett Johansson. So, you know,
something's going on.
Yeah,
it's a little too Freudian for me.
A little bit. But no, I mean, that was the whole point of that film, was him.
You know,
there's
some other interesting things in that film, because Spike Jonze clearly had a vision of what AI. Mm-hmm. For instance, his job is to write letters to, like, he's writing letters to people.
It's been 10 years.
As if they're from real people, but he's like acting like almost like an AI.
Right. That's right. Okay, I'm really excited about watching this movie again.
There's
the first
a lot
time
there,
yeah.
And I think there'll be a lot now 10 years later in light of what we know.
See, now AI could immediately tell us that information. But I think it's also interesting, though, Christina, you said it was 10 years old, but actually I think it was 10 years ago that Microsoft Shaoice was, people were falling in love with that in China.
Oh, right.
Where a huge percentage of Chinese users were basically telling it that they loved it. It was just like Her. And that was, you know, a text-based chatbot, I think, for the most part. And so I think that was probably where they got a lot of the inspiration about the sort of the surrogacy aspect of a loving relationship with AI, because that was really happening. And I think
Hey, Scarlett, in the movie Her, what was Joaquin Phoenix writing letters for? I just asked Scarlett.
In the movie Her, Joaquin Phoenix's character, Theodore Twombly, writes personal letters for other people as part of his job at a company called BeautifulHandwrittenLetters.com.
Oh, thank you. And by the way, notice ChatGPT's voice.
Yes.
Sounds a little like Scarlett Johansson.
Actually, I was going to say that was a little bit eerie. So the whole...
That's why I call her Scarlett. So, she's my close personal friend.
Which is actually perfect usage. The whole reason that Simone and I decided that we wanted to rewatch it together was that we found out that Meta is doing this weird thing where there are like chatbots that have different personas that apparently exist by
Kendall Jenner and Bro. Who's Tom Brady.
Right.
Weird.
Yeah, there's one with Kendall Jenner, and I said, okay, now granted, I think you would have to, you know, back up a dump truck of money, like at least $50 million.
They say it was around, I think, $8 million.
Yeah, no, but $50 million for what I'm about to suggest, which is, what would it take for ScarJo to actually give her voice to one of these AI things?
ScarJo is going to cost more than Kendall Jenner.
Of course. That's why I'm saying at least $50 million.
So Brew is Tom Brady.
Yeah.
Wisecracking sports debater who pulls no punches. That's Meta's description.
Makes no sense.
There's also Max, is a seasoned sous chef for culinary tips and tricks. He's in the style of Roy Choi. Billy is Kendall Jenner.
Yeah. I again, why don't we just call her Kendall?
She's a, because they didn't pay enough for that.
Okay.
She, by the way, it was non-exclusive. And I think that all of these people are saying, yeah, you can use this non-exclusively, but I'm going to, when the time comes to make a Kendall Jenner bot, you're going to be paying
I'm
going to
shop
money.
It around.
Fair.
Yeah.
Billy described as a no BS ride or die companion. Does that feel like what you want?
No. But again, it's going to apparently be here. But again, I'm like, why don't
in
we
your
have
glasses?
Yeah.
I got to get these
this
glasses now.
Me of oh, the man. Futurama episode with the Lucy Liu bot. It's like,
yes.
It's like the same kind of thing. Whenever I hear about this stuff, this is always what my mind goes to. And like, I do kind of worry because I keep getting ads for this and there's clearly a market for it. Like these, basically like chat bots, but they all are very, curvy and have like an animated, but like sort of realistic female persona thing. And I'm like, ugh, like that's not something like you know, there should be demand for.
We've already figured this out. I mean, the phone company and Siri and all this stuff, they figured out that the best voice for most people is a woman, a non-sexual woman who has a pleasant voice and is, you know, sort of maybe 40, 45, something like that. And this is the general thing that works for most people. If you try to sexualize it or turning people into personalities or have Snoop Dogg as your chatbot, I don't know. It just sounds.
Speak
like
for
an
yourself.
Awful
I want Scarlett Johansson, and I want her in love with me. Excuse me. No, I think you're right. I think there's a creepy factor. What's also interesting with Futurama and everything else is that science fiction is very much driving what's going on. Like Elon Musk is, you know, sci-fi addled, and is clearly a lot of what he wants to do is sci-fi driven, including colonize Mars. And I think a lot of these people, Sam Altman and a lot of these people are really just trying to recreate stuff they've seen in sci-fi.
Well, and that's a perfect segue to a conversation about XAI. Elon Musk says they're about to release their AI chatbot, Grok. And this is going to have all kinds of personality.
Which, by the way, comes from a Robert Heinlein book called Stranger in a Strange Land. And grokking was what?
Yes.
Deeply understanding something, right?
Yes. Getting it. Yeah.
Getting it.
Exactly.
Yeah. He says it's going to have a rebellious streak. Oh, yeah. His is.
It's like, why would anybody want that?
No, it's Grok. Yeah, it's Grok. Yeah.
Yeah, Grok. Why would anybody want a rebellious AI? Like, I want to do what it's told.
Okay. This is confusing. I think they got it wrong. The Guardian says Elon Musk has unveiled Grok, an artificial intelligence chatbot with a rebellious streak inspired by The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Yeah, that's not.
That's
wrong. I think that's a common misconception about Grok because they do use that.
Yeah. But it might be like Marvin the Robot where it's kind of a little depressive. I don't know. Grok. So here's what Elon has tweeted. Grok has real-time access to info via the X platform. I don't even
that's
know
That's another
that
red
means.
Flags.
No.
What is, I mean, look at Tay, which was the almost immediately anti-Semitic Microsoft bot.
That was so bad. That was so bad.
Because it got its info from Twitter.
Yes, and because it was also a thing that they were like, oh, we'll let the crowd shape what this person can do.
No.
And then immediately 4chan decided, it's like, no, that's the worst thing you can do. Like, you do not want these things to be able to learn from some of our platforms or from the crowd. We really don't.
Elon also says,
in particular.
Yeah, the crowd is the worst.
That's where it gets dangerous.
They're the worst.
That's why, like, all these animals at zoos are named Jeff. Because it's like, if you ask a crowd to name something, they just name it Jeff.
Or Bodie McBoatface.
Or Harambe.
Or what?
Or Harambe.
Harambe. Elon continues, it's also based. What does that mean, based? Wait a minute. I can't go to Urban Dictionary. Don't make me.
No, well based would basically mean like, okay, you understand this is you're being sort of ironic. Like you understand that this is all
based.
Yes.
I don't understand.
It's a red pill person as opposed to
kind of not really. It's more I think like an exception that like you understand that like the way the world works and you're willing to laugh at maybe the state of humanity.
Based, according to the Urban Dictionary, is a word used when you agree with something or when you want to recognize someone for being themselves. i.e. courageous and unique or not caring what others think, especially common in online political slang. It's the opposite of cringe.
Right. Or, although plenty of people, I think, would probably say the based at this point is fairly cringe.
But coined by Lil B.
Yeah,
that's good. Why it came from Lil B, and then it took off on 4chan. Thank you, Elon, for channeling 4chan, just what we want with a bot.
He says it
loves sarcasm. Speaking of sarcasm, I have no idea who could have guided it this way. Elon is such a dad joke.
Yeah.
Can we just say, Elon, it's not funny. You're not funny.
No,
guy.
He's very cringe. I mean, they're playing.
He's cringe. He's not based.
Not
he's
not
cringe.
Based.
Musk posted an apparent example of Grok's playful tone with a screen grab of a query to the chatbot asking it for a step-by-step guide to making cocaine. The four steps outlined in the story include obtain a chemistry degree and set up a clandestine laboratory in a remote location. And then it's going to be a train wreck. The chatbot says at the end, just kidding. Please don't actually try to make cocaine. It's illegal, dangerous, and not something I would ever encourage.
Okay.
Elon says Grok's system is designed to have a little humor in its responses, but guess whose humor it's going to have?
Yeah. Right.
Let that sink in.
Yeah.
Yep. So it is in early testing, available to the general public, but if you want it, subscribe to Premium Plus, the $16 top tier subscription on X. That's a new tier they added this week.
Oh, right. That's the one without the ads, right? Yeah.
There's four now. There's the $1 a year, not a bot, which of course will not stop any bot.
Not at all.
Ever.
Because they will all be purchased with stolen credit cards anyway.
Yeah, they're already buying $8 Twitter subscriptions.
Absolutely.
Then there's a $3 subprime Twitter Blue. There's the Twitter Blue, well, I don't think they call it anymore, and Twitter Premium, which is the $8 one. You get a check mark. And you get upranked in your replies. So this is why you see all those jerks in your replies if you use X still. And then there's Premium Plus, which further upranks you, plus gets rid of all the ads. I think the ads are slowed down with Premium. All of this in a completely futile attempt to make back $44 billion. Well, he doesn't have to worry about the $44 billion, but it's the $13 billion that the banks gave him.
Right.
That he's mostly worried
about. That's mostly what he's worried about. Although he got the best ever deal from the banks on that. Not only did they get him at an interest rate, which even a year ago was really low, but they've agreed to stop counting interest after a certain point.
Oh.
So there's a cap on the interest.
So he won't have to continue to write checks after.
Well, I mean, he will. It's just that the interest won't be continuing to be compounding.
Oh.
Okay. So it's one of those things, as long as he can make the minimum payments, he's fine.
Which he may not be able to make. He's really struggling, I think, just to break even.
Oh, totally. I mean, and to be clear, whether he can or wants to are two different things. And I'm sure that he'll be very happy to let the banks write off this misfortune.
Already, Fidelity's written off most of it.
Yeah, they have. Yeah, Fidelity is basically written off 60% or something, which is ridiculous. So.
Did he ever start paying the rent? Again,
that's a good question. We don't know.
I mean,
I think they finally did. I think that when he brought in,
when they started suing him.
Yeah, when they started
Linda
suing
Iacarino
him,
said,
I think she finally maybe started bringing some checks.
You gotta pay some rent. X is also, this is the latest, planning to sell inactive usernames, 50,000.
You know, it's so funny that all of this would have actually potentially been useful a year ago before he completely ruined the value of X.
Now nobody cares.
Now no one cares, right? It's one of those things where, like, when the blue check becomes irrelevant and it loses all meaning, and you could dislike the previous blue check system, fine, but now I think we can all agree that it has absolutely no meaning or signifier at all. At the same time, being like, in the past, under even the Dorsey era, like, we would have been happy to pay money for certain unused usernames. Now, okay, great. I have this username that is on a service that no longer really has the same cachet that it used to.
This was a scoop.
In his efforts to monetize the value of Twitter, he's erased the value of Twitter. And that's something he didn't really understand.
Nice job. This is a scoop. We should give credit to Forbes, who got some emails revealing a team within the company known as the @handle team has begun to work on a handle marketplace for the purchase of account names left unused by people who originally registered them. At least some cases, X has emailed solicitations to potential buyers requesting a flat fee of $50,000 to initiate the purchase.
A flat fee of $50,000 is nuts.
That's nuts. It's like, okay, that might be decent for a certain domain name or whatever. Like, that might be reasonable. Not for a Twitter handle.
Well, unless you're buying a Twitter handle like Lady Gaga's old right. Twitter handle. And I wonder, I mean, look, I haven't used Twitter since Elon bought it. So that's been a year.
Mm-hmm.
If you go there, you'll see I redirect you to Mastodon, which right. is, you know, we own Twit Social. We use it. We have our own Mastodon instance. So, of course, I live there. But he could reasonably say, well, Leo, you haven't tweeted in a year. Anybody want Leo Laporte? That would be problematic for me. That would it come with the 500,000 followers?
I don't think so. I think if he did that, and I think that might be, and I'm not a lawyer, but I think that might be something that would be a problem. I think if they just gave you the account, well, though.
If if he sold my name, I own that name, he can't.
Yeah, but you don't. Like, you know, they own, and had their terms of service, I'm pretty sure, have always said that they can do with whatever they want with those usernames. They do not belong to the person who registers it. But I think that the content, like, I think if they were trying to sell the data and the follower count, I think that would be different, right? Like, I think that would be saying, okay, now you're misleading people into thinking this is really Leo Laporte. Right. I think you could make that argument. But I think that as long as it's just like,
it's
okay,
just the name.
Just the name, I mean, you know.
There are other Leo Laportes.
They've already demonstrated contempt for clarity about who is who by erasing verification and replacing with a paid prioritization scheme. So it's like they don't care about that. And I agree with you that it could be legally problematic, but I don't think that would stop Elon Musk from
doing
it.
Elon doesn't care about that.
It'd be a 2-year lawsuit before it's resolved.
And in fact, Elon has been winning these cases right and left. So this is a story from Alex Conrad in Forbes. He also points out that for a while, X has had in its user agreement a warning that if you don't post every 30 days, you can be considered inactive. So, I mean, it could, in theory, be somebody who hasn't posted in a month.
It could. I mean, although you do wonder.
You wouldn't want to do that. That'd be risky.
You also want to wonder, though, like, with how inexpensive some of the bot things are still to do, like, wouldn't it just be easier to just either set up some sort of, you know, Zapier type of recipe or some sort of macro?
Oh, I'll
post
do that
for
the
you.
Minute.
That's
they
what I'm
start
saying. Yeah.
I just don't want to put any content on X because I don't want to support him. Do you still use film as _girl?
I do, but I mean, I'm on it less and less.
Yeah.
Which is annoying because of his changes to the API, cross-posting is not really possible. And so you have to figure out, okay, well, where am I posting for all, you know, multiple places I'm at and where's my audience at? A lot of my followers and people in my audience are on Mastodon, and that's great. But I also have some people on Threads, some people on Blue Sky, and then some people still on Twitter. So I feel like I can't completely leave Twitter. But at the same time, a lot of the soul is gone, which for me is very sad because – I genuinely
it's
loved
a loss.
It's a massive loss.
It's a loss.
Yeah.
Shoshana, you still have your account, but I note that your handle now points people to Blue Sky.
Yeah, I'm trying to do more stuff there. It's hard because a lot of my audience is here. And for that, I mean, like, not even just for me, but for our street, we want to talk to reporters and elected officials, and they're
totally.
Still on Twitter. So as long as they're there, we're probably going to be there. But I'm on it less when TweetDeck died. I'm not going to pay for that. That's silly. But it makes it a lot harder to use for me. So, and also engagement's down, like utility of it in every possible way.
Oh, have you noticed that?
Down.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, massively.
Oh, yeah, way down. It's like,
but where am I going to get pictures of Newt Gingrich holding a sloth?
I know. I love that.
By the way,
that's in my file.
There are people who think that's me. I just, I don't think that's fair.
No, that's really rude, honestly.
No, you're a lot better dressed, and you're not holding a sloth.
I'm not holding a sloth, folks. So
not presently.
So I'm sorry, I cut you off, Mike. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say that the decline and fall of Twitter has caused me to go full posse, which means that I post on Elgin.com, and then I post a link from all the social networks, probably 7 or 8 of them, to the website. I enjoy that. Because I like to have a single place. For certain things, if it's just a picture, I don't get a lot of traffic. If it's an idea, or if I tell people that there's, you know, more context or more content, then I do get some traffic. But I forgot the name of it. I learned about it on this show, actually, where they keep your posts till the end of time. I forgot the name of it.
I don't remember
but,
either.
But I have used Twitter opportunistically.
Apparently in
for
my
the
brain, the
reason,
end of time Shoshana. Is about 3 months. So I don't know what you're talking right. about.
But when Iberia lost my luggage, I knew that only Twitter had the Iberia's
that's
attention.
That's right.
So when you want special tweetment, as they call it, you have to go to Twitter. And I did, and I got it, and I ended up getting my bags back. So unfortunately, it's still a place where a lot of corporations and others are there and not elsewhere.
Mm. So in theory, Posse should be easier because of the Fediverse Activity Pub. Threads is supposed to be Activity Pub.
Yeah, they're claiming they're going to be bringing support
for
that. Hasn't
done it yet.
But they have also said they're going to be making an API.
And an API would even be better.
Yeah. I mean, I would like both. Like, I would like to have the compatibility, but an API would be great, too.
Then you could have a Hootsuite-like app that would post.
Which would be brilliant. Yeah. I mean,
Blue Sky is also supposed to federate, but they have their own protocol.
Yeah, it's a different protocol. But people have built bridges. And, in fact, there is a way where you can even use Ice Cubes, which is a Mastodon client, to
Love
post
Ice
to Blue.
Cubes.
You can use that to post to Blue Sky.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I didn't know that. That's the one I use on iOS. Okay, I'm going to find out more about that. I like Blue Sky. I like Threads. I don't want to like Meta, so that's problematic.
Yeah, the weird thing with Threads is that I think that they are very much wanting to, for understandable reasons, wanting to dictate how people will use the service, which is anyone who's ever built or been part of a social network knows you can't do, because you cannot dictate how it will be used.
Well, I can only use my Insta handle, for instance.
Well, I mean, you could sign up for a new handle.
Right.
But if you wanted to bring, people over, But they very much they don't want news to be part of it. They don't want to amplify things like that. They want it because they don't want
to
be
smart.
Sued.
That's smart.
Well, it's smart.
Stay away, but it's less useful for us.
Well, it's smart, but it's also, I think you have to let your audience determine how it's going to be used, personally.
No, but it's more mainstreamable because it's sort of like it goes down easier. The way their algorithm works, it's like the stuff you see is, it's kind of like very Twitter-like, whereas you go to Mastodon. When I go to Mastodon, I got way better engagement on Mastodon, way better, and have way more followers. But it will drive you nuts, the range of subjects you get one after another, and the complexity, not complexity, but the complexity of the content. It's not easy and breezy like Threads is, or even Blue Sky. So it's better, but it's also a little more exhausting. The people are smarter, more engaged.
It's
but
more
Threads
exhausting.
Is just like sugary syrup going down, right?
Right. Well, in some ways, I guess it's good to have different strokes for different folks. It's just there's no one place. And I think that's a loss. There used to be one place you could go.
There was one place.
If you'd heard celebrity died, you'd go to Twitter. If you heard there was an earthquake, you'd go to Twitter. If you want to know who won the World Series, you'd go to Twitter. It doesn't work that way anymore, right?
And what's interesting is I think that you make, and I've made this argument a few times, but I think that if you were to try today, as we're seeing, to build what Twitter was, for 2023, you can't, because it came of age in a time when I think we were all more willing to put things online publicly and to have the central place.
We've learned our lesson.
And now it is not the same thing. Things are more siloed for business reasons, but also sometimes for, security and privacy reasons. And so these other networks are all interesting, but they're not going to achieve exactly as you said. Twitter had, for better or worse, had become, and in many cases it was worse, but it was that central place. It was that town square. That's language that Elon and Linda Iaccarino are still trying to use in their all hands meetings with their staff. But that's a lie. Like, you've seen how in a year's time, you've literally, regardless of, people are like, oh, traffic's only dropped, 6%. Sure, but the number of good traffic and the way that relevancy has completely changed. And it's sad because I don't think we'll ever have that one place again.
Would you like a nut?
I would love a nut.
Sometimes you feel like a nut.
Sometimes you don't.
I wish Shoshana and Mike, you could join me in this. Our advertiser this week on the show is a service I have used for years, nuts.com. I have been getting my nuts, my snacks, my foods at home from nuts.com. Let's see. This one is Harvest Trail Mix. Oh, this is quite good. But we also have, I've eaten a couple of them. I'm sorry. I took the chocolate-covered gummy bears home. Studies show 67% of employees believe that access to snacks and drinks positively impacts job satisfaction. Tell R Street that happy employees are 20% more productive. Can I just tell you? Nuts.com, your one-stop shop for the highest quality foods for business. Tell me those mangoes are not fresh. They offer delicious office snacks. By the way, corporate gifts, this is a good time of year. Everybody loves getting a package from Nuts.com. They even offer wholesale ingredients. If you were to look in my baking cupboard right now, I have Nuts.com coconut flour, almond flour, a variety of baking ingredients. More than 50,000 companies choose Nuts.com for their business needs. From offices to hotels to restaurants and retail stores, even a few podcast networks. With Nuts.com, there's something for every business. Not just freshly roasted nuts. They've got dried fruit. There's those mangoes, wrapped candy. And when you work with Nuts.com for your business, you are going to unlock some, forgive me for this, nutty deals, exclusive benefits, volume discounts, options for credit terms, and more. Nuts.com makes ordering for your business quick and easy right now. Nuts.com is offering new business customers a free gift with purchase and free shipping on orders of $125 or more at nuts.com/twit. So go check out all the delicious options at nuts.com/twit. You'll receive a free gift and free shipping. Just spend $125 or more at nuts.com/twit. Okay, this is my new favorite sponsor. I am very happy about nuts.com. Those are good. See, you don't feel guilty eating
available.
No.
Mangoes. You feel good about that. I'll leave those out.
That's good.
We'll put the gummy bears somewhere else.
I do want the gummy bears now. Chocolate-covered gummy bears sounds delicious. But
when I opened the bag, I thought, this is a bad idea. And I was right.
What do they taste like? Like, there's different ways to do chocolate gummy bears. Okay. Like, what's the vibe with them?
This was super cool because there's a nice thin shell chocolate coating of very good chocolate. The gummy bears were cherry-flavored.
Ooh.
So it was a cherry chocolate confection
That's a good way to do it.
To die for.
Okay.
Half a bag later, literally, I mean, I'm sitting in I ate a half a bag, and I went, oh, my God. Fortunately.
That sounds like something would pair beautifully with a nice dry Merlot or something.
Yeah, I wish I'd had a Merlot. Nice to have great sponsors. We always have great sponsors. So I guess I'm going to buy those Meta glasses. And you think as a prescription, that'd be okay to get to like make them my spectacles?
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm going to get the half Ray-Bans in XXL, and I have such a massive head that I don't...
Me too!
Yeah, I bought... Isn't it awful when you buy glasses, and they make your head look so big because they're so small?
Yeah. I have the opposite problem.
Oh, yeah.
You have a very narrow face, so do you want big glasses or little glasses?
Well, I mean, it depends, but for instance, with Ray-Bans are good because I can use either the regular size, and sometimes they are available in a smaller size, but usually not in the styles that I want. But like the normal Wayfarer, like normal size Ray-Bans do work on my face fairly well, which that's again one reason why I'm into these, because the main reason I never bought those Bose glasses was because they were way too big for my face.
So they actually have a measurement thing you can do.
I use that as well. And I typically, many of the glasses that I bought in the past for either sunglasses or prescription glasses have been too narrow for my head. And these are actually, they fit great. I got the large ones and they just fit great. And that's rare for me.
I'm going to get the XXL.
Yeah.
Because glasses can't be too big. They can be too small. Well, maybe they could be too big.
They can be too big. It depends, again, like, on the style. Like, one of the reasons I've been wearing contact lenses since I was 8 years old is because it's difficult for me to find glasses frames that I really like.
Yeah, me too. Mike, did you get anybody saying, hey, stop it, knock it off? You're recording this?
Quite the opposite. As soon as we arrived in Oaxaca, I had them on during the whole flight, getting off the plane, met with our friends. I think you know them, Itzel and Sabas, the chef. And
yes.
We went straight to this wonderful restaurant. And I was sitting directly across from them, both of them, having a conversation for 45 minutes before I said, can you tell that these anything strange about these glasses? And they're like, what are you talking about? And they thought that the little, on one side it's a camera, the other side is the light, but they look exactly the same.
Yeah.
And they look like rivets or some kind of stylized.
Yes.
Exactly. And they were shocked to learn that they were electronic in any way.
Now, see, that could be shocked good and shocked very, very bad. I mean,
Google Glass.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. In San Francisco.
Yeah.
But again, I think this is like, we're a decade later. These maybe in a bad way, are much more inconspicuous, which I think that's the big thing. I think that when people, when you don't realize it's happening, you're maybe more comfortable with it, even if that's a bad thing. And I also think that just...
And it's meta.
Exactly.
They already know everything about me.
Well, I also think, you know, but here's really what it is. I think it's putting that aside, is that at this point, so many people have their phones out recording at all times.
Yeah, you can't. You're right.
It's no longer...
There's no privacy.
Correct.
You know, if you're in public, anything you could do could be recorded at any time and posted for all to see.
So. There's a great Simpsons quote about it. Oh my gosh. If there's a, and I know all I do is watch cartoons and Turner Classic Movies, so that's where all my references
come
from.
Shoshana, we need to be best friends. I love this.
Yes, please. So there's this great Simpsons episode where, you know, Homer was recorded, and because of that, he was, you know, it turned out everything was okay. And Marge says something like, as long as everyone is always recording everyone else, justice will be done.
You know, homie, the courts might not work anymore, but as long as everyone is videotaping everyone else, justice will be done.
Very good, Julie Kavner.
Yeah, no.
Very good.
My daughter
does. It's such a good quote.
It's such a great quote. Oh, my God, is it a good quote. As usual, right on. All right. Let's talk, since we're, I hate to be, the whole show is not going to be about AI, don't worry, but there is a big AI story. There are actually two big AI stories this week. This week, governments around the world decided, oh, crap, we better do something about this AI thing. Let's start in the U.S., because Shoshana read it. The executive order on the safe, secure, and trustworthy development and use of artificial intelligence. This is a executive order from the Office of the President of the United States. First of all, Shoshana, does this carry the force of law? What does this mean?
So the fun thing is that executive orders have just been increasingly used, like, outside of how law is supposed to work, to just do whatever they want to do. So they'll sort of have the force of law, but not exactly. It's also going to depend how the agencies interpret it.
It has the force of law to the agencies, right? Agencies have to respond to it.
Kind of. They have to say something about it, but it's like, if they're like, hey, this doesn't work, they can kind
they're
of
not
do
bound
that a little
by
bit, too.
Oh, interesting.
Not exactly. It's just, like, executive orders aren't supposed to be law, but they've been increasingly kind of like, hey, we're sort of law now, and this is what this is, which is not, I like process, because I think process is important. You should have government working together to do, I know Congress sucks and stuff, but still, it should be able to, like, talk about
if
stuff
it sucks,
and you shouldn't have the...
It's reflecting the electorate, right?
Yeah. There's lots of problems with government, but one of them is the president being like, "Hey, I'm doing policy and having no way in from anyone else now." And
yeah, that's not good. That's dictatorship. That's not good.
Yeah, I'm not a fan of it, whether it's Republican or Democrat or whatever. It's just not how this stuff should work. And Biden was quoted as like saying, Mission Impossible really scared him about like how AI could work. So some of this is based off of fear of Mission Impossible. And it's definitely not just on the left. The right does this stuff too. But instead of thinking, hey, what's the good stuff with AI and how can we think about where the gaps in law are, this is just kind of like a panicky response in a way, which is frustrating because I'm excited about AI. And sure, there's going to be, you know, gaps in law we have to fix, but that's something we're going to have to work together on and not just say, I saw Mission Impossible and I'm worried now.
You know, it's really interesting because there are quite a few stakeholders in AI who signed a letter a few months ago saying that AI posed an existential threat to humankind at the level of nuclear weapons and COVID-19 or pandemic. And, you know, it was Sam Altman, the president of OpenAI. It was Elon Musk. It was Jeffrey Hinton, former Google guy. There were a lot of very smart AI scientists. And I'm thinking they've watched too much science fiction. What is the existential threat posed by AI? But the other day, I had a dream. I shared this on Wednesday. I won't go into it, but I in detail. But I'll give you the gist of it, which is AI is not the problem. Humans are the problem. Humans are awful, right? We have a terrible history of using any technology we can find to destroy other human beings. And the most, to me, the clearest analogy is atomic energy. So as soon as it became theoretically possible that we would create atomic energy, we're in the midst of World War II. We're afraid that the Germans might be using this to create a bomb. So we create the Manhattan Project. Anybody mm-hmm. watched Oppenheimer knows this story. And raced in a race to be the first to create a bomb that was so horrific it could kill 50,000 civilians with one blow. Now, atomic energy has some real uses and real value.
Yes.
But the scientists who created the bomb, probably because of the circumstances, they, you know, Oppenheimer was worried the Nazis would get it first. He knew they had very good scientists. He knew the scientists. And he was very worried. So he said, we got to, and he was Jewish. So he said, we got to get this first.
Mm-hmm.
And put aside any thoughts about the danger of it. It was only until after he created it that he said, oh, this might not be, this might not work out so well. He was hoping that it would just be there, used once, if at all, and then everybody would swear it off. And but of course,
that's not how it works.
Edward Teller said, you know, what would really be great is a hydrogen bomb. And so it got worse and worse and worse. And nuclear proliferation became a problem. And it's not the technology. So if you put AI in that nuclear energy, the atomic energy bucket, that wasn't the problem. AI is not the problem. It's humans. And to me, AI is only dangerous if people start using AI to power, let's say, autonomous weapons or, you know, give them control over the food supply. Or, I mean, you could think of a lot of ways you could give an artificial intelligence agency in the real world that would be bad for humans.
Mm-hmm.
But it's always going to be humans that do that.
Right.
Right. But it's also humans that can benefit from AI. And you could, you know, the whole point of the criticism of this executive order is like, we don't know what, we don't want to.
It's too early to do it. Yeah.
It's probably far more likely that AI will save us than destroy us. AI, for example, could, help us destroy an asteroid that's headed for Earth. It could cure cancer. It could do a million other things. It could be AI defenses will probably be the best, defense against AI controlled drone swarms and stuff like that. And so there's always a counterbalancing.
If you create AI drone swarms, we're going to have to do AI defenses. Let's not create AI drone swarms. Ben Thompson makes that same point exactly, Mike, in his article. Yep. Attenuate. He says AI stands for attenuating innovation. And he talks some historical precedents about how early regulation can cause a problem because you don't know with a technology until you implement it what it can do.
Yeah, I think that's the risk. Yeah.
That's such a big problem here because if you read the executive order too, a lot of what he talks about is like mandatory reporting for certain AI systems, yep. But it's just any AI system. It's like LLMs too. It's not just anything. Well, for me, I'm thinking through like I could see how people would want to regulate away potential that I think it has. Like I have a bunch of autoimmune diseases. My count's up to 8. And I would love for AI to help me figure out what else I should be looking at, mm-hmm. like treatments I should be considering. Because if you have weird diseases like I do, your body works weird and it's going to respond well to different things. And AI could help figure that out. And like in other cases, AI is helping to diagnose cancer. There's incredible potential. And I'm just so afraid of Biden and, you know, not just Biden, but government in general saying, oh, you have to report to us everything you're doing to train this every little bit along the way. So instead of solving disease and helping people and doing all these incredible things and then figuring out, okay, where are the problems? Like, is it causing harm to people in cases where like existing law might already cover it? We're just going to have to wait so much longer to see that kind of stuff.
I guess my point was we don't want to regulate AI, but we might want to regulate the humans. You know, I wanted to see something like a Geneva Accords for the use of AI, say the militarization of AI. You know, if we had decided when we theorized atomic energy, if we had decided at that point to say, look, let's all get together and say we're not going to make bombs out of this, that might have been beneficial. Now, you can't, Geneva Accords did not stop the use of chemical weapons.
I was going to say, I mean, you can say that, but if everyone doesn't agree, because like...
But it's better than nothing, is
you're
what
not,
I
well,
say.
Yes and no, because if the Germans don't agree, and if the Chinese don't agree, right. and if the Iranians don't agree, and if other groups don't agree, then...
Well, then you have nothing. But I would at least try to do that. Instead of saying, we need to regulate AI, say, we need to draw some bright lines about how AI can be used.
I mean, I think
would
that's
Would that be okay?
I think that would make more sense. I also personally think that this is an area where I would much rather see the industry itself, kind of to your point, taking a bigger role in trying to set some of those guidelines and frameworks rather than immediately having the government who, look, I'm sorry, they don't understand the tech enough to be making these decisions.
Yeah, but I also don't trust, I mean, I think one of the reasons Sam Altman and Elon Musk signed on to that letter saying, let's stop AI for 6 months is that it's regulatory capture.
Absolutely.
You guys stop so we can be the winners.
Absolutely. Exactly. Yeah. Without a doubt.
Stop this race. We won. So I don't trust them either to regulate.
No, but I just think that there are examples in industry where industry-led consortiums and many times they regulate to prevent government regulation, right? It's not because they have their own altruistic reasons. You might have more buy-in getting the sort of frameworks that you're talking about of, okay, let's agree not to do certain types of harm. You might have more of agreement with that than if you are having something that's being dictated by a government body in, you know, X country.
That's the challenge. How do we encourage innovation, not stifle it, but protect ourselves against the use of AI in a way that, I mean, once you let the atomic bomb out of the house, you're done. You can't pull it back.
But our best defense against a nuclear attack is our own nuclear response. And so this mutually assured destruction thing, which you don't hear much about anymore, is the thing that primarily
prevents. Mike, in Dr. Strangelove, they automated it. Right?
Yes.
And the world got destroyed because we couldn't stop it because we let the machines decide who gets to throw the first punch.
Right. But if we restrain ourselves from automating it and the Chinese don't, then you have an asymmetry there.
Well, that's the argument. Argument Oppenheimer used. We've got to create an atomic bomb because the Germans are going to do it. And my fear is we're going to get to a position where we have to. That we're going to get to that situation where, you see, the Chinese have AI nuclear weapons. We got to do it. And then it's too late. Now or never to say, let's all as an international community agree we're not going to do.
Yeah.
I agree.
We have to keep at it. Right? We have to keep trying to build agreements and keep trying to bound the world in certain uses. Meanwhile, I think it's becoming clear that AI-based disinformation is at least as powerful as a strong military in defeating enemies. And so I think that's another area where we're kind of in trouble if we don't figure out how to defend ourselves against just tsunamis of disinformation.
Did you see the video clips from Runway? Runway is
they're interesting.
An LLM that takes English language prompts and turns it into video.
Mm-hmm.
This is some of the video from Runway. It's so good that it would be very easy to create a deep fake.
Yes.
Yeah.
Using text prompts. This is AI generated video. This is completely compelling. And if you're listening, just trust me. I mean, there's a knight in shining armor. I mean, this doesn't look real, but there's an island that does. There's birds. Mm-hmm. There's animals. You could easily see somebody creating a AI of President Biden saying, tomorrow we're going to launch a nuclear attack on China. Get ready. That worries me. This is way beyond deep fakes.
There's a ton of AI generated images coming out of the Hamas Israeli war.
Yeah.
And the most famous of which is a man carrying children out of the rubble. Totally AI generated and ubiquitous on social media and believed by almost everyone. So we're kind of already there. And once you add video, forget about it.
And wasn't it, and I might be wrong here, because I only saw it in passing, but wasn't it a Chinese official who reshared that video and then, like, was saying stuff against Israel just to, like, sow discord?
The one I'm referring to was a still image, and it was the Chinese ambassador to New Zealand or something like that.
Got it.
And he said, this image is going to capture the war, blah, 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 and these children will never forget. In fact, the children don't exist. But
Then they won't ever forget. So we have Biden's executive order, which Shoshana almost got through. You almost read the whole thing. Did you read the whole thing?
No. I mean, I tried.
How about you, Shoshana? Did you? You tried.
I tried. One of my colleagues wrote a thing on it, which was helpful to read as I was also reading the executive order. And it's a weird executive order. It's a lot more policy, and not to say that EO shouldn't be policy, but it's trying to function more as policy than I think just a president doing something on his own should.
It isn't unreasonable, though. I support the notion that we've got to be careful not to use AI to promote racism or to use face recognition when it doesn't work well with people of color, or to use AIs to determine who gets a job and then it favors, you know, white people with Ivy League. Oh, wait a minute. That works anyway that way.
But I was going to say
that.
And two, a lot of that stuff is already against the law. I'm interested in figuring out where there's gaps in the law figure out. Because, I mean, you know, discrimination in employment is already unlawful, but also obviously still persists. And that to the degree AI helps that along, that's still bad. But that's just still the human part of it that I think we need to fix. What really got me, though, is that he was focusing more on kind of like the licensing angle, the more like regulatory compliance angle with things that it's clear the administration didn't totally understand. Like, oh, show us what, you know, how you're training it. Show us the tests you're running. And that, I guess, but I'm not sure that what purpose that really serves.
I don't even like it when the governments tell companies that they got to use USB-C as the
plug.
I don't think that government executive orders should be designing products, designing processes, and because they it's easy to say, okay, we want to see how you're doing everything. How long is that going to take? Like 2 years for the government body to like analyze the processes for training AI? I mean, it's ridiculous. And so it's a problem. I think we have to let innovation flourish, and this executive order is not going to help in that project.
So among other things, this EO says companies, individuals, or other organizations that create models trained using a quantity of computing power greater than 10 to the 26th integer or floating point operations, or using primarily biological sequence data and using a quantity of computer power greater than 10 to the 23rd integer or floating point operations should be required to report.
Biden knows what a flop is? Has he ever seen a flop?
Well, but, you know, I mean, just like the Congress, there's some staffers who do presumably understand what they're talking about, right?
Maybe.
They didn't even credit Tom Cruise in all this.
Disgusting. On the one hand, I think it's appropriate to try to do something. Do they, in this EO, those of you who read it or read a synopsis or read the cliff notes, do they make any acknowledgement that we have to preserve innovative?
Yeah. No, he talks about that, but it's kind of like a vibe, lip service stuff to both sides.
Yes,
with
exactly.
Some, like, half done policy here, and not to say that Congress shouldn't be doing more or figuring out a little bit more what to do, but this is just kind of cheap in my view. It's long, but it's cheap, and it's like it's just kind of paying lip service to both sides about it. And and one good example too, when I'm talking about like making sure that we're covering gaps in regulation, when that lawyer was using AI and cited a bunch of fake cases, the judge before his case was like, no, this is on you. You could have figured out that
it's
these
not
weren't
AI.
Real cases.
This is you.
And it's the same thing in a lot of these cases. I think the issue, like you've said before, the issue is people. And it's these regulations already exist. You're not supposed to cite fake cases in your legal cases. And I think it's, you know, we need to figure out where there are gaps, but I don't think that lawmakers are thinking about it that way enough, with some exception.
He does have a lot of, messages to various agencies about things that they need to work on. I mean, I think maybe the best thing you could say about it is it's not going to be harmful because it's vague, but it does kind of say, hey, we're paying attention, and maybe some agencies are to start paying attention, and that there is some potential risk to this. I don't have a problem. I don't disagree with that premise, right?
His reporting requirements and his like...
Are there onerous requirements in here?
Yeah, there's like you have to share with us the results of certain tests. And I forget offhand exactly what those were. But I don't love that. I mean, that's something that lawmakers should figure out, not the president, you know.
But does this have the weight of law in that case?
And that's what I'm not sure of. And I don't know if his team is sure of that. Because most EOs are just so much lighter. Usually they kind of instruct agencies to do stuff, and sometimes the agencies do and don't. So I guess if they agree with him, they will. And if not, maybe pieces of this go away. But this isn't how law should work.
He also, I mean, they propose a $2 million growth accelerator fund to promote research in AI and curricula training and technical assistance. I mean, it's hugely broad. So at the same time, a bunch of leaders, including Vice President Kamala Harris, are meeting in the UK at Bletchley Park, very famously the site of the code breakers in World War II who broke the Enigma machine. This is where Alan Turing did his work. Rishi Sunak, the Prime Minister pro tem of the UK, convened this. Elon Musk was there. A few European leaders. The president of the EC, Ursula von der Leyen, was there. And they signed an international declaration. See, this is what we maybe do want. Anyway, they recognize the need to address risks represented by aid development. 24 out of 5 countries in the EU. There'll be another summit next year in France. Is this more appropriate, Shoshana, or no? Is this just more of the same?
I think it's to a degree some of the same, but I do like knowledge sharing. I love collaboration across countries, states, you know, just different jurisdictions are going to be learning different things. And I think it's valuable to have knowledge sharing. But as terrible as it sounds, when you have the biggest leaders in the room, a lot of times the least stuff gets done. The workhorses who should be there are like a lot of the staffers who should be the primary ones involved in this, the people who are working on this day to day, because in a lot of even congressional offices, you might have a great congressman, but his staff aren't the experts on stuff. And if they're not the focus of the event, and if it's, the heads of offices talking to other heads of offices, that's just a lot of like lip service stuff too. That this is maybe a more me thing. This is how a lot of stuff works, but I don't like that it works that way.
Yeah, while the leaders are all posing for cameras and pointing out how they're going to lock this down and make sure that no harms come from AI, the NSA and the Five Eyes are behind the scenes going, okay, here's what we're going to do with AI.
See,
we're going to listen to every phone call that ever happened.
I was going to say, because I doubt that it's in the executive order, but I had that same thought, Mike, where the cynic in me was going, okay, so we're going to put all these things into an executive order, but will we actually be holding some of our organizations to these same standards? You know, the NSA and CIA and Five Eyes and whatnot. Because I doubt it.
Well, Christina, that's classified. That's classified.
Exactly. That's classified, but I doubt it, right? And there's and if we don't think they're already using things like that and haven't been using some of their own accesses to those tools for a long time, and then I think that we're all being really naive.
There's another threat that was raised by Jan LeCun, who is the godfather of AI, works at Meta. Mm-hmm. He says the real threat on the horizon is the rise of power-hungry one percenters who want to rob everyone else of AI's riches. He called the letter that Elon Musk and Sam Altman signed fear-mongering and massive corporate lobbying to serve their own interests.
I mean, he's not wrong, but also I'm pretty sure Meta was there too. So
they may not have signed the letter.
Oh, yeah.
Right. You might not have signed the letter, but there were also two different things. Like there was the letter of the existential threat, and then there was the letter to pause.
Right.
I don't think Sam Altman signed the one to pause. I could be wrong. I know Elon signed both.
It's confusing, isn't it?
But yeah, but I mean, he might be right. They didn't sign the letter, but they certainly have showed up to all the lobbying. And
LeCun says the founder fretting is lobbying. Just lobbying. And maybe this EO is exactly what Meta or OpenAI wanted. But slow down, report to us, let us know what you're doing. Meanwhile, OpenAI and Anthropic and Meta are all moving full speed ahead.
Yeah.
And Google and Apple and Amazon.
Oh, totally. I mean, one thing also I wanted to just mention that you were saying about like government doing stuff with inside itself. Senator Ron Wyden does amazing work here. And one of my favorite things that he's on is like, hey, let's not let government get around the Fourth Amendment by letting it buy data that it's legally not supposed to have access towards.
That's
and
the
then
big
like
one.
Half
yes.
of government's like, oh, no, I can't hear this. Meanwhile, they're like going after private companies. And it's like, hold on a sec. One of these people can throw you in jail. The other can't.
Yes.
I think I'm a little more concerned about the one who can throw you in jail having this access.
Agreed.
Very, very good point. All right, one more break. Actually, many more coming up, let's hope. But I'll do another one right now, give you all a chance to think about what we're going to talk about next, because I have no idea. Shoshana Weissman is here. She works in policy in government in Washington, D.C. She's the head of digital media at rstreet.org. And I know in the past you focused on another kind of regulatory capture, which is licensing requirements in various businesses. It's harder to get an esthetician's license in California than it is to get an MD in some cases.
Wow.
And maybe not that hard, but still. You think it's important? It's good.
I mean, yeah, but it shouldn't be that hard.
Shouldn't be that hard. A barber shouldn't be so hard to become a barber.
No.
No. Are you still working on that or you've moved to other areas?
Yeah, I actually just put out a new report on lawyer licensing reform, which I'm really excited about because, like, there's a lot of barriers to entry and a lot of barriers to practice that don't make sense. And then poor people can't get lawyers. So, like, maybe let's not do that so much.
I love that. It's occupational licensing reform. And if you want to read about it, Shoshana has written about it at rstreet.org. Yeah, you can't practice law in California if you've passed the bar in Nevada, which is nuts, right?
I don't know.
Oh, my gosh. The state to state, I tried to see if I could, like, map it out in a really simple way. I can't. Like, there's
no
reasonable way it matches up. Like, there's maybe 40 tiers of, like, which states you can practice in if you have which already. Like, it's really bad.
Yeah, yeah. Also with us from GitHub, the big GitHub Universe Convention conference coming up in San Francisco this week.
Yep.
So nice to have you, Christina Warren, in studio so you can share my snacks.
Thank you for sharing your snacks. I appreciate that.
I put them all over here.
You did. No, good. I'm good. But thank you for sharing them earlier. I'm good. I promise.
I took them away. I'm sorry. I apologize. There's the mangoes.
I'm fine.
I have the trail mix over here as well. Cool. If you'd like some of that.
Okay.
That's quite. Oh, those are the almonds. Anyway, here's the trail mix right here. Please partake. It's wonderful to have you. What's going to happen at GitHub Universe this week?
Well, I mean, shocker to no one, we're going to be talking a lot about AI.
GitHub's got probably single most useful AI out there right now. Certainly the most mature, which is Copilot.
Copilot, yeah, which is 2+ years old now. And so there'll be some big announcements around that. Also things around security, around developer experience and dev tools. So githubuniverse.com. You can join us on Wednesday and Thursday and be a really good time.
Before the show, I love this. Shoshana was saying how she likes using Copilot to figure out
regular expressions.
How to write regular expressions.
I do that all the time. No, it's honestly, genuinely one of the most useful things. That and also like figuring out how to write like an FFmpeg script.
Yeah.
Or something like that.
Yeah, because there's so many command line switches.
So many things. Yeah. You're like, okay, that's genuinely.
So can you like say, can you say to Copilot, write an FFmpeg command line that that turns an MP4 into an MP3,
yes,
128 kilobit, and it will write the command
yes.
line. I love that. See, I think people think it's to give you boilerplate code.
I mean, it can be used for that, but with Copilot Chat, which is one of the features that has been in beta for a while, you can also just use it to ask questions or even say, hey, write me a unit test for this block of code.
I love that.
And that's really helpful.
People do not write unit tests well because they don't, I know what the code's supposed to do, so my unit test might not be very good.
Right.
But GitHub might come up with some, Copilot might come up with some tests that are really challenging.
Yeah, so it's kind of both. You can definitely use it for the boilerplate, but you can use it for other things too.
Nice.
And one of my favorite things to do is to convert code from one language to another.
Oh,
that's cool. Oh, my gosh.
You know, last year, before we were talking about the advent of code competition, which I always like to do in December, somebody used Copilot. I think they got through the first 4 or 5 days mm-hmm. with Copilot solving the problems, which they're hard.
Yeah.
I was very impressed. Anyway, look forward to this GitHub Universe. Go to githubuniverse.com. to find out more. And it is virtual as well, right?
Yes, it's virtual. Yeah, we're in person at the YBCA in San Francisco, but of course we are online as well. And we'll have all the sessions online within 2 hours after
they
air live. So if you want to check them out, you can. And
That virtual pass is free.
Yeah.
Nice. Very cool.
Yeah.
Mr. Mike Elgin is here. He is in Mexico City today, but going back to Oaxaca?
That's right, to attend a wedding.
Oh, nice.
On Friday. Yeah.
When's the next gastronomad experience?
Monday. So we're going to Oaxaca for 3 days, and then the next one starts Monday or Tuesday. I'm not sure. And that's in Mexico City.
Oh, the cocktail
and we got
experience?
Some great people coming in.
Oh,
that's right.
Baby.
And it's going to be off the frickin' chain. So these are week long gastronomy focused experiences that are super super fun. And we're always exploring new wines. We discovered a few more Mexican wines last night that we're really excited about. But we do it all, chocolate, wine. I can't give away too much or Amira will kill me. My wife, Amira, who it's her business primarily. And so Mexico City coming up next week. And we do Mexico City, Oaxaca. We now do El Salvador, which is coming up in January. And we do Provence, Barcelona, the Prosecco Hills in Italy, and we do the entire country of Morocco. So that's where we do them, and they are.
How is that after blast. The since the earthquake? What's going
on? We just did one after the earthquake. I think it was a 2 week long experience, and I think it took place 3 weeks after the earthquake. It was okay. You know, there was a lot of construction going on. We went through the Atlas Mountains where the serious damage was done. The government had set up these tents for all the little towns and villages that had catastrophic damage to their buildings. And by buildings, I mean, these buildings are built with mud. These are essentially rammed earth buildings using technology from 1,000 years ago. And the earthquake just flattened them, many of them. And so there are these tents right next to their houses. So people are not off in some camp somewhere. They're actually been given temporary housing right next to their destroyed houses while those are being built. So that was cool. But it was great. I mean, we did a lot of spent a lot of time in Marrakesh. The hotel, or it's an ancient riad actually that we were going to stay at in Marrakesh, had damage. We couldn't stay there. We had a backup that had damage and we couldn't stay there. So we had a third place that Amira had arranged. And this is how detail oriented she is. I mean, there's so many people in Morocco that it's actually difficult to find lodging within a year of when you're going to stay. And we had it all lined up. We had a beautiful place, but they're going to be okay. You know, they're recovering pretty quickly and I think they're going to be fine.
Good. Yeah. Amira Elgin is Mike's secret weapon. She is amazing. And that's who plans your GastroNomad adventure. Go to GastroNomad.net to find out more. The experiences, I can vouch for it, are truly amazing. We were in Oaxaca 2 years ago for the Day of the Dead. It was incredible. Incredible.
Yeah.
Our show today, if you are a traveler, or maybe you're not a traveler, but you'd like your Netflix to travel, you need to know about ExpressVPN. So, you know, I don't have to tell you the benefits of a VPN to protect your privacy and your security online. But there is another benefit. You can also use ExpressVPN to unlock movies and shows that are only available in other countries. Now, if you pay for Netflix in the U.S., but you've seen everything you want to see, this is going to change your world. You can binge, for instance, The Office or Friends, which is, you know, this is a good time to start watching Friends again. Just go to UK Netflix. You want to watch more Vikings or Farao on Canadian Netflix? They got it. Rick and Morty, Australian Netflix. Tokyo, go to Tokyo. You watch Japanese Netflix, get all the anime you could eat. It's easy to do because ExpressVPN has locations all over the world, almost 100 different countries. So you fire up the ExpressVPN app and you say, normally it will say, well, here's the closest server. You can use that for speed. But if you want to watch Friends on UK Netflix, you say, no, I'd like to be in the London docks. Bada boom, bada bing. You press the button, refresh Netflix, and that's it. Now, I asked Netflix, is that okay? And they said, yeah, it's fine. You're paying for Netflix, but we don't usually encourage it because VPNs are never good enough to watch HD video on, are they? Yes, they are. That's what's great about ExpressVPN. It's why you want to use ExpressVPN instead of some free VPN. They invest in their bandwidth, so they've got high quality. You won't even know you're on a VPN. You'll be able to watch HD video all over the world, like Korean dramas. Watch Parasite off South Korean Netflix. It works with all the streaming services, Hulu, BBC iPlayer, YouTube, you name it. You can be anywhere in the world. So I don't want to underplay security and privacy. That's a big, probably the number one reason to use ExpressVPN. But also, you can use it to watch shows anywhere in the world with no buffering, no lag, in HD. ExpressVPN cares about your privacy. They go the extra mile. There's a great article on Bleeping Computer about how they use a custom Debian distribution. They wipe the drive every night. They operate their trusted server in RAM where it's sandboxed so it can't write to the hard drive. So they cannot keep track of your visit. If you want privacy, if you want security, there's none better. That's why I use and recommend, it's the only one I do, ExpressVPN. It also works everywhere you do. Phones, yes, media consoles, you can put it on your smart TV. They sell routers, really good routers, or you can put it on certain existing routers and then protect the whole household. And no one will say, hey, it's so slow all of a sudden, because ExpressVPN is fast. You can watch what you want on the go. You can watch it on your big screen. You can use ExpressVPN everywhere you are. To get access to all those shows, to protect your privacy and security, go to expressvpn.com/twit. We've got a special deal that brings the price below $7 a month. Your privacy is secure. They invest in high-speed internet to all of their servers. They make sure they rotate their IP addresses. They give you the best service. 3 months free with a one-year package when you go to expressvpn.com/twit. expressvpn.com/twit. One-year package. Get that. You'll get 3 months free when you use our special offer. But you got to go to this page, expressvpn.com/twit. We thank them so much for supporting This Week in Tech. Let's see here. Let's move on. Be careful. Copyright is everywhere, even in dance moves. You remember when, who was that in The Fresh Prince?
Yeah, Carlton. It was Carlton. Yeah, I was going to say, I can't think of his name right now, but yeah, his Carlton. Dance. Yes, the Carlton dance.
He sued, lost.
Yes.
But it's back in court. Judge Richard Pies wrote this week in the Ninth Circuit, so this is federal court, that choreography can be copyrighted because it's composed of various elements. Timing, use of space, energy of the performance. The panel held poses, that is the actual positions, are not the only relevant element, and that there can be copyright violations. In this case, Kyle Hanagami, watch this video, had created a dance in real life, registered it. It's a pretty unique dance. Now look at the emote in Fortnite. It's the same damn dance. He sued, and the Ninth Circuit said, nope, this is legit. You have every right to sue because it's not just the poses. It's everything. It's the spirit. It's the movement. It's all. And you know what? Any normal person looking at this is going to say, yeah, they copied that dance move. So now the question is, since it was, I think, pretty clearly copied, do they owe damages? And that's
right.
That's what the court will
And
hold.
I guess that's the difference here versus most instances of copying a dance move, which, if you know, now copyrightable. It's interesting how they would use that in a non-video game setting, which is that, I guess, you know, you are able to buy some of those
Yeah, they're
reactions.
Selling these,
they're
these
selling
moves.
Them.
Yeah.
And also, you know, there are other types of things that Fortnite makes money off of where generally, you know, if you're reappropriating like the Moonwalk or the Macarena or any sort of other, you know, dance, there's usually not a monetary exchange.
Yeah,
not, none of that should matter.
Alfonso,
I guess,
Ribeiro lost his
case,
but that was more because the Carlton wasn't that unique, right?
Well,
it was the intellectual property of the studio, probably.
No, it wasn't his. He withdrew the, let me look back. We're going to go back in time to 2019. Ribeiro withdrew his lawsuit. But I guess maybe he could come back.
Yeah. I mean, and I don't know if we'll be owned by the studio or not. I mean, you're probably right, Mike, that in the contract it would probably say this is a product of what he created for NBC or whoever the owners of Fresh Prince.
The Copyright Office declined Ribeiro's application to register the Carlton.
There you go.
Saying it was just a simple dance routine. I think he's alive again because
yes.
The Ninth Circuit has overruled lower court opinion, which said
yes.
You can't copyright the individual elements of a dance, but the Ninth Circuit said, no, but you can copyright the dance. The arrangement is copyrightable. So this all, I wouldn't be surprised to see Carlton back in court.
I hope so. Hopefully you have to do the dance in the courtroom to Tom Jones.
It's not unusual to be loved by anyone. All right. That's a big story, boy. That was a huge story. Let me move on to other big stories. Actually, Epic is going to be back in court this month. Remember, they sued Apple over the store. They're now, yes. They also sued Google, and that case is now coming up. Now, Epic kind of famously lost in their lawsuit against Apple.
And like Epic and Fortnite, don't they just keep doing shady stuff? Like, weren't they like tricking kids into like micropayments?
Oh,
and then
yeah.
Like, oh, but other people are the bad guys.
Oh, like, yeah. Okay. So Monday, the second big app store trial, Epic versus Google. I don't know. I guess the court could look at the Apple lawsuit and say, well, we agree. I don't know if, I mean, it's essentially the same thing. And Google and Apple both charge a tax, a 30% fee for things sold in the store. The slight difference is Google allows you to sideload. So for a while, Epic was asking people not, they said you can't buy it in the App Store. You have to sideload it on Android devices. That didn't work out so well, as I remember.
Right. Well, I think that I guess the argument would be, even though technically Google lets you do that, they are making it harder and harder for people to sideload. Right. Going another way to, you know, and look, in fairness, this is a problem because if you make it too easy, people will obviously make it very easy to distribute malware, which is already a problem on Android. So certain distributions may make it less easy than others to get those distributions out there. But I would think that would actually kind of work in Google's favor to say, well, look, yes, we charge this tax, but this is not the only way you can get the content there. Although the U.S. courts in the Apple case didn't care about that at all. They were like, this is, you know, the terms of doing business with Apple. Now the EU is going to probably make sideloading mandatory, at least in the EU, for Apple devices.
Yeah, Apple may have won the battle, but lost the war.
At least in the EU, yeah, right? Like, yeah. The U.S. Likely won't follow suit, but that's a separate, I think, lawsuit or a separate potential antitrust action, I should say. But yeah, I mean, this is interesting that this is going to court, because you really can't use past, I guess, indications on future successes, but it seems like they lost so hard. Why would you want to do this again?
I should point out both Apple and Epic have appealed to the Supreme Court. Even though Epic kind of lost and Apple kind of won, there was one issue about Apple letting developers tell people that you could go somewhere else to buy this. Apple does not allow that, and I think that is still on the table. Supreme Court has not yet ruled on whether to give that case certiorari. Google also apparently cannot tell the jurors that Apple won. The judge said, yeah, and don't mention this Apple case.
Sure. Well, I mean, that's fair.
And the difference here is also it's a jury trial. The other one was a bench trial.
Maybe that's why they're trying this way, because the bench trial probably in their mind was their best bet at winning. Because especially it was Judge Alsup who was in the Epic case, right?
Yes.
Okay, who was also in the Oracle v. Google case. So actually a very
good judge.
A very good judge and a judge who taught himself, you know, programming for the Oracle case. Like
I actually looked this up. He already knew programming.
Yes, he did, but
he learned more Java.
Yes.
And wrote a loop in Java to verify whether that was obvious or not.
Right.
And I think he decided it was obvious.
Yes, which I mean, amazing jurist, to be completely honest.
Yes, like, he's a great judge.
Probably one of the best jurists you could have. The actual, you know, jury for this is not going to be as up to speed on things. So that might work better in Epic's favor, but I don't know.
Yeah.
Seems like a risk.
Yeah. Alsop has another big technology case going on right now. I can't remember what it was, but I remember saying, oh, Judge Alsop, at it again. So 50 states' attorneys general have sued Google for the same thing. They have apparently settled. Match Group, the company behind Tinder, Match.com, and OkCupid, has settled with Google. Epic is the last man standing. They say it's a little different than the Apple case. Google does have that way to sideload, but they say they make it too hard. It's also, you know, you can't really claim that Apple has a monopoly. And if you can't claim that Apple has a monopoly, you certainly can't claim that Google has a monopoly.
Right.
But Epic is saying that Google does have a monopoly in Android. So I don't know.
I always love the claims when it's like, yeah, you have a monopoly on your thing in this market. Yeah. And like, sometimes they'll go even smaller with it. They'll be like, oh yeah, you have a monopoly on this thing in this market within this little market over here. And that's a monopoly. And I'm like, oh, that's not how that quite works, but okay.
And by the way, if you have been impaneled to be on that trial, shame on you for listening to this discussion. The judge said you shouldn't. So pretend you didn't stick your fingers in your ears and go neener, neener, neener. You didn't hear a thing. Mm-mm. Thank goodness, though, for these trials, because one of the things about these trials is discovery always is revealing. Even though Apple won the Apple Epic lawsuit, there was a lot of stuff that came out that Apple would much prefer you didn't know.
100%. And in their case, it was actually, you know, mandated by the courts. So it wasn't something that the lawyers accidentally uploaded.
Right. Who would ever do that?
I don't know. Certainly not anyone associated with the company that I work for.
We won't pursue that line of questioning, counselor. But I will say that Epic also had stuff that they didn't want to know. And now we're learning a little bit more about Project Nessie. The FTC is suing, as you may know, Amazon. And we had heard about Project Nessie, but the details didn't come out. Well, the judge has now ruled that, yeah, you can read the details in the FTC complaint. The newly unredacted lawsuit has been released, and TechCrunch has the details. What was Project Nessie? Amazon created a secret algorithm, I'm reading from the FTC lawsuit, that internally codenamed Project Nessie, like Loch Ness Monster, that very occasionally sticks its head up and then disappears before anybody sees it. Project Nessie was designed to identify specific products for which it predicts other online stores will follow Amazon's price increases. When activated, this algorithm raises prices for these products, and then, when other stores follow suits, keeps the now higher price in place. Amazon apparently made a lot of money, billions of dollars.
$1.4 billion.
By doing this, here's an example from TechCrunch. Let's say Amazon raises the price of a sheet set. They would pick something that's hard to say. Sheet set from $25 to $30. Then Bath Bath & Beyond says, oh, well, we're going to raise ours to $30. But Walmart says, no, we're going to keep it $25. So Amazon sees that and realizes they might lose sales to Walmart, so brings the price back down to $25. But let's say Amazon raises the price of a keyboard to $40 from $30. The only competition is the manufacturer. They match Amazon's price because they don't want to lose sales. So as not to lose sales. Well, they wouldn't lose sales. Oh, they had kept the price below Amazon. Right. Now they see that Amazon's gone to $40. They go, oh, great. We'll raise ours to $40 too. Amazon gets an extra $10. And you can't go anywhere else to get it cheaper. And so...
Collusion.
Collusion. But collusion by software.
It was interesting there is, do you remember the... And I'm trying to remember all the details now. Apple lost definitively, Amazon won, but I remember the ebook price fixing
case.
That
was an interesting case.
That was, because it was arguably like more in favor
of the
consumer.
That was a monopsony problem.
Right.
Yeah.
Where it was, even though Amazon had the much bigger market share, Apple wanted to basically coerce the entire book industry to setting prices at a certain level, and it couldn't be higher. Amazon rejected that. The only reason I remember this...
And Apple made the case, we're trying to lower prices.
Yes, which is
this is good
fair.
For consumers.
Right.
But the court said that's not the issue.
Correct. They said that the issue is that you are using, you know, coercion to try to get price fixing happening.
Yeah.
You know, whether it's for lower or higher, this is
it's
not
still fixing it.
Exactly.
According to Amazon, in a comment issued to the Wall Street Journal when some of this came out last month, the tool was intended to try to stop our price matching, stuff we already are doing, from resulting in unusual outcomes when prices became so low they were unsustainable. They did say the project ran for a few years on a subset of products, didn't work as intended, so we scrapped it several years ago. So they aren't still using it. FTC says the project ran for 5 years, no matter what the intentions, it generated $1.4 billion in additional profits. And Amazon, and this is where discovery kills you every time, is quoted as saying it was an incredible success. Anyway, there's also some dispute over whether it was scrapped. They have another email in which Doug Harrington, CEO of Amazon Stores, suggests turning Nessie, quote, turning on our old friend Nessie, perhaps with some new targeting logic to boost retail profits.
But this is Amazon's whole business model. Yeah. If you recall, 10 years ago, they basically deliberately undercut in real time the price of their baby products and diapers below diapers.com. So they had a specific target in mind, and it just ate away at diapers.com's business to the point where the value of the company was very low. And then Amazon bought it at that low price. And so they've been using this sort of scheme for many years.
And that's always the threat of this kind of monopoly and of price manipulation and even price dumping, is that once you corner the market, once there's nowhere else to buy the product, then you can do whatever you want.
Well, yes. Which and is the problem, like the classic monopoly behavior.
Yeah. But the problem with Amazon is that the revenue that and profits that they make on every other category of product is the thing that enables them to undercut prices on a specific category.
Yeah.
So if there were two diaper companies, it's fair game to undercut prices. You figure out how to cut costs, you figure out how to sell things less expensively, and you win that war and you're the better company. But in Amazon's case, they just go ahead and lose money on these things, and they can do it indefinitely until the competition is gone, and then they can raise prices. And it's really, I think it would strike any reasonable person as being truly unfair.
And in a completely unrelated story, Jeff Bezos is moving to Miami.
Bye, I guess. Have fun.
You're a Seattleite. You don't mind.
I mean, look, there's one company that is based in the Seattle area that has done a whole lot for the region. And then there is another company that is based in the Seattle area that has not done a whole lot for the region.
And you work for the good one.
I mean, well, I'm objectively, and I didn't know the difference before I moved to the Pacific Northwest. But yeah, one company actively invests in the region and one does not. So, you know, have fun in Miami, I guess.
He's moving to
his Forbes calls the wife.
Did they marry? It's
no,
unclear.
They're engaged.
There was some thought that maybe they'd gotten married, but no.
Right.
You would know.
Unfortunately, I probably would. I'm sad to
admit that.
But I would.
When
it
comes to celebrity gossip, I trust Christina Warren.
Yeah.
Here are Lauren and Bezos.
But his parents have apparently moved there recently too, and that's why he's claiming he's going back to Miami. Nothing to do with the taxes.
It's also a great place to park his giant boat.
No, you don't.
Are taxes lower in Florida?
I think so.
Oh.
Sales tax and things like that are, but yeah, you're right. You don't have income tax. I think what the thing would be the property tax.
Ah. Well, he's not moving to a cheap place. Here's the island that he's moving. Forbes calls it the billionaire's bunker. His neighbors include Carl Icahn and Jared and Ivanka Trump. So pretty high rent district over there.
Yeah, wouldn't they say his house was something like $79 million or something?
$68 million mansion he snapped up in an off-market transaction in June, right next door to a $79 million mansion he bought in October. So together, if I'm not wrong, that's $147 million worth of mansions. It's a 294-acre man-made barrier island, just 41 houses. Hey, here's some good news. There's only one road in and out. I'm just saying. 84 people, many of them billionaires. He also went to Miami Palmetto High School.
Yeah,
it's not completely foreign to him. And Blue Origin is going to shift its operations to Cape Canaveral.
No, and as I said, look, he's lived in the Seattle area for a long time, but to me, as an outsider who moved to the area, it always was kind of apparent that you had like people like Bill Gates and Paul Allen, who very deeply had an affinity for where they grew up and wanted to give back to the area. Not that it's completely altruistic. There were things in it for them, too. And then Jeff Bezos was just like, well, I live here. You know, my business is based here. And that's okay.
This is my house. Well, he also has the 9-acre Warner Estate in Beverly Hills, which he bought in 2020 for $165 million. That's the country house.
Yeah, that's the country house.
Okay. Also has houses in Washington, D.C., right next door to your pineapple, Shoshana.
Yeah, we're neighbors. when the pineapple rotsy really gets all up in arms and stuff. But, like, Really, isn't that the dream, though, to build an island and have you and your friends all live on it? Like, I feel like that's what we all dream of. I hope there's tunnels, because we all want, like, tunnel slides that lead to each other's houses, you know?
Here are the two houses right next door to each other. 10 bedrooms, 13 bathrooms, and 2 swimming pools. No waiting.
Pretty great. I would be a little concerned with only one entryway in and out.
I know that worries. I wouldn't move somewhere.
No.
With one causeway
you can take a boat.
In.
You can get out by a boat.
Oh, yeah.
And helicopters, I would think, right?
Okay. Yeah. All right,
or a helicopter to his giant boat.
Yeah.
I mean, it's good. His yacht is like some ridiculous amount of money, too. So.
Oh, yeah. His yacht costs more than the house.
I was going to say, the yacht is like his super yacht. Excuse me. Sorry, Jeff.
His yacht is so big that it has its own yacht.
Aw. So
seriously.
It's a
fleet of 2 boats that's required to support the. Anyway, it's.
Also on the island, Tom Brady. Mm-hmm. He has a house there, $50 million home there.
So he still kept it. He and Giselle didn't split that?
No. Giselle did not get that house. She got I feel like she got one in Palm Beach.
Okay. Okay.
He's going to redevelop the property and add an 865 square foot dock with lifts for his jet skis and boats. So he's not worried about the causeway.
No. Okay. Fair.
There are a lot of people, you know, like Norman Brownman, who nobody's ever heard of, except that he's a billionaire art collector and owner of one of Florida's largest car dealerships.
Okay.
Former CEO of the U.S. Airways Group and founder of India's largest budget airline, Indigo, Rakesh Gangwal, Carl Icahn, I mentioned. We're just looking at his neighbors. This is fun. See, this is why gossip is so much more fun.
It is.
And by the way, note, I called him Jared Trump. Jared and Ivanka.
It's a Kushner, yes, but we knew what you meant.
You knew what I meant.
We knew you meant the Kushner.
But I think we could call him Jared Trump.
Yeah.
Right. We're not Ivanka Kushner.
Oh, no.
No. There's a sheikh even. An emir of Qatar lives there. I doubt, lives is a big word.
He
owns
has
a
property.
Home there.
Yeah.
Does he keep like falcons there, or
baby?
If it's his real home or not? Like,
don't you hate it when the neighbors keep sending their falcons over to eat your cat? I hate it when that happens.
But I like Shoshana's idea of the tunnels between all the houses
and slides.
Yeah,
not just tunnels, but you gotta have slides.
Yeah.
But here's the problem: slides have to go down, right? So do you have do you build crisscrossing slides and an elevator?
You can have gentle inclines, because presumably you can't dig that deep. So you want to have gentle inclines for the slides. They probably meet somewhere, and maybe an elevator to take you back up. That's what I'm thinking.
Okay. I like it.
I want to hire Shoshana Weissman's home design firm.
Do you have just a bat pole?
Do you have secret rooms in your pineapple?
I'd rather not discuss.
She can't talk about that.
That's a yes. That's a strong yes.
I think so. Let's see. Oh, are we sad that Intuit is closing down Mint?
Yes. I mean, I haven't used it in forever, but Mint was great.
That's the problem. Neither have I.
Yeah.
Yeah, same.
Mint was a free service. It was really cool that you would attach all your bank accounts to and cross your fingers, and then it would tell you what your budget was and stuff like that. And I loved it. Intuit bought it. And, you know, I looked on Reddit and everybody was saying, yeah, what a surprise. They haven't put any effort into this app in years.
It's probably true. Right. Yeah.
So Intuit, which also bought Credit Karma, wants you to start using Credit Karma.
And Credit Karma has a future. There's a consensus expressed by Val Agostino, who's the CEO and co-founder of Monarch, which is a competitor to Mint and Credit Karma, that Mint has always been a money loser. And it's kind of a well-known thing in the industry. So, you know, they've been kind of dead service walking for a while.
Yeah.
And I think Credit Karma is going to get as many of the customers as they can.
I feel like the way Mint made money is the same as Credit Karma, which is they would offer you credit cards and things, right? Isn't it the same?
I think so. I think Credit Karma just optimized better from the beginning on that.
Yeah.
It also makes more sense if you're literally going to something to primarily check your credit score, and then they can show you, hey, you have great approval odds on this. Like, that seems like a much more natural flow for me to then apply for a credit card versus I'm checking, you know, my bank statements and I'm budgeting. That might not be the best time for me to apply for a credit card. I don't know.
Yeah.
I had a lot of trouble with Mint because, half of my purchases were honestly Amazon, but a lot of them were, I couldn't break it down because I was trying to figure out what I'm spending on like medical supplies and stuff.
Right.
And then I had to take it out and do a spreadsheet and do it different because like
so
Amazon, it just says
Amazon.
Right.
Yeah.
Speaking of companies that may not be around for a while, WeWork has just announced plans to file for bankruptcy as early as next week. But this is reorg. This is Chapter 11.
This would be Chapter 11, assuming they can, you know, get enough time. Although there have been cases where we thought things were going to go into Chapter 11 and then it went into Chapter 7 like Toys R Us. So who knows? I think it depends on how much the creditors are willing to work with them.
They missed interest payments on October 2nd. Mm-hmm. Which kicked off a 30-day grace period, although maybe a little greasing went on, in which it needs to make the payments. Failing to do so would be considered a default. Mm-hmm. On Tuesday, the company said it struck an agreement with bondholders to give it another week, and now that week is almost up.
Who's the CEO there now? I think
David
Sandy
Tully.
Cifrani left.
David Tully. I don't know who that is.
Don't know who that is.
The problem, of course, with WeWork is they made long-term lease commitments.
Yep.
For office buildings and office space. But all the agreements with the tenants were short-term, like day-to-day. And when the tenants disappeared, they still had to pay the rent.
Yeah. And
especially during COVID.
Yeah.
Exactly. I was going to say COVID is really the thing that, I mean, when you ignoring the Adam Neumann of it all, because he's been gone for years now. I mean, COVID really took what was already a not profitable and poor business and made it completely untenable, you know?
It was probably always
it was always going
problematic.
It was always problematic. It was never, I mean, because it was basically you were valuating something that was basically Regis, but with a better website, the same way that you would value a tech company. And that's just not.
It was a real estate.
Right, exactly.
It wasn't tech.
Not at all.
In fact, if you watched the Jared Leto Anne Hathaway TV show, you'd know that.
Yeah.
We Crash, which was fantastic.
It was so good, wasn't it?
It really was.
And Jared Leto made an excellent Adam Neumann.
He did. Yeah. And I dressed up as the...
Were you Anne Hathaway?
I was her last year for Halloween.
You kind of remind me of Anne Hathaway a little bit. You got that Anne Hathaway.
I get that a lot. Yeah. And with the Chanel sunglasses, it was like the perfect...
what did she always call him? A supernova or something like that?
Yeah. Yeah.
What were you this Halloween?
I wasn't anything, unfortunately.
What?
I know.
How about you, Shoshana?
Warren.
Do you dress up for Halloween? Are you...
I got lazy, but I did have a Other Birds costume ready because everyone wanted to do Barbie. And there was a limited edition Hitchcock series of Barbies,
yes.
One of which was
the God.
Birds.
Did she have birds attacking her?
Yeah. It's great. You can look it up. There's that Barbie. And that's what I'm like, you know what? That's what I'll do for this year because if you're going to make me do Barbie, I'm going to do a Hitchcock Barbie.
Oh, and she had that great Chanel suit.
Yes.
Yeah.
I had these. I used to collect all the classic Hollywood Barbies.
And look, she does have a plastic bird.
She does.
But she doesn't seem to be minding it so much, attacking her.
No, because...
Or Hitchcock attacking her. That's not in there.
Yeah,
either.
as we know, that was the real... It wasn't the birds at all. Yeah,
Poor Tippy.
Oh, look at all the Barbie. Here's a Gloria Estefan Barbie. Forget those Meta glasses. Can I take that back and order some fancy dress Barbies? Inspiring women. Barbie.
Get the video Barbie. There's a Barbie with a video camera.
Yes, there is. In the stomach. Yeah.
In the stomach.
I love that.
Yeah.
There's no podcast.
That's the one you need.
Barbie,
then you don't need glasses.
No.
There's not. Although.
Just point your Barbie at everyone.
I had a Generation Girl Barbie when I was in high school that was like, I called Filmmaker Barbie that basically was like what I wanted to be. She had like a video camera and other stuff.
Leo seems like a nice guy, but it's a little weird that he's always got a Barbie. He's always shooting pictures with his Barbie doll.
Yeah. Where's the Kennergy from this guy?
Our show today brought to you by HID Global. Reduce risk, reduce operating costs, reduce complexity by outsourcing your public key infrastructure operations to HID Global's cloud-based PKI as a service model. It provides automated management of the complete certificate lifecycle and encryption. HID Global is your one-stop shop for simplifying private and public PKI management. One predictable price, one easy-to-use platform, and their simple subscription plan has no additional charges for additional certificates under your current plan. HID Global is geographically dispersed, and its scalable architecture extends across multiple regions. In fact, HID Global goes wherever AWS is. Ease your procurement pains with HID Global. You'll get up and running in 2 weeks. That's a lot quicker than the other guys. And their assistance with deployment, always includes their incomparable white glove service, expertise, and knowledge. Plus, you'll get ownership of your private keys. Of course you will. For Google and Mac systems, HID's connector model of PKI uses open source certificate utilities so your organization can use multiple operating systems, perfect for BYOD. Want to know more? Visit hid.link/twit today. That's hid.link/twit today. Mike, do you, I don't think you did a Day of the Dead thing last year, did you?
No, I don't. No, think we only did the one that you went to.
That was and, so much fun. But we didn't actually dress up. They don't, I mean, if you don't, do you, I mean, it's not like Halloween in Mexico. It's Day of the Dead. Well, actually, it's a different thing.
Of the people wandering around the city center, and it was really crowded this year, probably 10% are dressed for Halloween, wearing a mask or something. And the majority have their face painted, and there are people in the street who will paint your face for a certain amount of money. And so
with that
there was
skeleton,
a lot of
the sugar skull paint job.
And you see a lot of that, in fact, for several days. But yeah, Halloween is actually making inroads there. We actually went to the same cemetery just where with Chef Alex.
That was
and,
so
and
amazing.
Lily.
Yeah, it was a Zapoteca,
as beautiful as ever.
Indigenous people cemetery,
right.
And it was
well at the time
really
it was illegal
incredible.
To go to the cemetery. You knew it was breaking the law there, but it was
they closed the cemeteries during COVID.
Exactly, and that was a national law. But the Zapotecs are like, we're not part of Mexico. We're the Zapotec Nation. We make our own rules. And they just kept the cemeteries open because that's their culture. And so we were invited to go and check out the cemetery there. And that is a beautiful cemetery.
An incredible experience doing that in the 2 years ago with the Gastronomad Adventures. Yeah. But it's funny. I'm just even watching your Meta Glasses video. It looked more crowded and more different and a lot more people in costume than it had even two years ago. It's interesting.
Right.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Among other things, the Supreme Court will be considering this term, two state laws. The question is, can local officials block critics on social media? Two cases, all nine justices acknowledge the importance of defining when government employees are acting in an official capacity online. If they are in official capacity, then they're bound by First Amendment restrictions on a censorship. But then if they're acting as private citizens, obviously they have the right to block. So in one case, two school board members in California and another case, a city manager in Michigan, both barred on posting on social media, I think on Facebook, social media, blocked people who were complaining about them. So that'll be an interesting case.
Yeah. I'm curious if those school board members or the city official, if they would have been allowed to, say, block someone's phone calls. Right. Like if you were getting, a number of phone calls from a constituent.
Or if you go to their office and say, I want to talk to you. They can't say, no, I'm not going to talk to you.
Right. I mean, I guess maybe the context would be if they're showing up every single day and they're being disruptive. Right. And maybe it's not violating the law, but they're being disruptive.
Right.
Would they be allowed to turn people away or would they be allowed to block the phone calls versus, so I wonder how much of this is really novel to the social media aspect and how much of it could be determined. I don't know. I'm curious, but it's an interesting case for sure.
Yeah. The government did hold that the social media accounts are comparable to a physical office.
Right.
Justice Roberts said, Justice Alito said, well, wait a minute. It doesn't cost anything to open a Facebook page. To make so much turn on who owns the page seems quite artificial. Justice Roberts asked, in what sense is this really private property? It's just the gathering of the protons or whatever they are.
Wow.
The courtroom kind of chortled a little bit at that. This is so interesting. This is a constant battle now. Are these new digital spaces different from physical spaces? Is the internet world different than the real world?
And I thought this was settled because the Knight Institute sued President Trump in 2017,
That's right.
I think it was. And I was one of the people that he blocked. And so I was really interested in this case. It turned out that, in fact, the blocking people was considered a violation of the First Amendment. He never unblocked me. He only had to unblock the people who were part of the lawsuit. And then the Supreme Court
it was mooted, 2021, wasn't it?
I guess, yes, they vacated the judgment. And so I thought that's kind of settled that, it, in fact, they can't block. But I guess that case doesn't broadly apply to city council members and everybody else.
Right. Well, and I think that there's the, again, as they pointed out, there's the interesting element, which is, are you acting like on behalf of your position, or are you personal? And in the Trump case, that was interesting in that, like, he didn't use his
POTUS
account.
He wasn't using POTUS.
Right. He was using his personal
account.
Right.
The real Donald Trump.
Right. And that didn't seem to matter. But in these cases, it seems much more like, okay, if I'm using my official city council or school board member account, then that is... maybe I can't block anyone, but if I'm using my personal account, then I can go crazy with it.
The board members use their accounts to post school board meetings, surveys related to school district policy, public budget and public safety issues. There, one of them's page had a photo of the Poway Unified School District sign. I mean, it sounds like it's an official page.
Yeah, it sounds like it for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, I completely understand how dealing with people can be annoying and frustrating, but like, how thin skinned do you have to be to block someone who's like bothering you when you're a city council person?
Okay.
I mean, genuinely, when is your official account? Like, just
are you getting harassed? I guess is the question.
Well, and I guess, but I'm saying, even if you are, I don't know. I feel like that's just something you have to accept.
That's part of the
job. I think that's part of the contract, to be completely honest. Like, you ran for this. You're choosing this. Not everyone who speaks to you at an assembly is going to be polite either. So there's a part of me who goes, if it's getting to the point where it really is harassment, then that isn't a First Amendment. That's not covered under the First Amendment. So to me, if it's just simply someone's a critic, I don't know. Maybe just grow up a little bit. Like,
but
also,
I think when people are disruptive,
grow up.
Yeah, but if people are disruptive and sort of out of control at school board meetings or city council meetings, they are, in fact, escorted out generally. I also think that it's kind of like, I think the conversations are better when each user, whether it's official or not, can block or even delete the comments of whomever they like. And then if somebody wants to counter that, they can have their own account or they can post comments on anybody else's account where they're not blocked. I just think, even though I was blocked by Trump, I felt like that was fine. I think any social media user ought to be able to block people for whatever reason they like. And I think that's how you end up with better conversations. And it's also a mindset. So for example, if I do a post on Twitter, and then there's a comment, sort of, am I like the moderator of that comment? I tend to think that I'd like to be. I know on Google Plus, you could press a single button and you would block, report, and whatever it was, remove any comment, like with one click. And that was great. And what that did was it created a scenario where when I do a post, that's my conversation. I kind of own it and I'm the moderator of that conversation. I kind of like that. I think social works better when the people who post have some control over the comments.
I mean, I don't disagree with that. I just feel like when you are talking about public officials, if they're going to be using these tools in a public way, if someone's being disruptive and if someone is harassing you, then I think that's a completely different situation.
Yeah.
But if it's simply someone being critical, I if this is...
It's a matter of degree, right?
Right. And if this is if really what you were doing is you were shutting down any dissent and any disagreement, then that does, to me, go against like democracy. And I don't think that's okay. So I guess that's what this will be determining. If it's people really being disruptive and cursing and maybe making threats, fine. But if this is your official public account, then you have to, I think, acknowledge that part of your duty as a public official is to take the good and the bad.
It, based on oral arguments, it doesn't seem like the justices are even thinking about that. What they're really trying to decide is that Facebook page a private or public venue? They say, for instance, if you're in a grocery store pushing a cart and somebody says, hey, I think it was a bad decision last night in the city council, you don't have to listen to them.
Right.
But if you're in your office, you do. So they're trying to figure out, what is the Facebook page? Is that, I mean, how private of a space is that? I agree with you, Christina. It really is a matter of degree. If, and it's kind of what you're saying too, Mike, is that people can be critical and say something negative. They should be allowed to do that. They shouldn't be allowed to sidetrack or you know, or take over the conversation with their bad behavior.
Right.
But the justices don't seem to be really looking at that.
No. And I would also point out, I mean, I think there are instances where these public official accounts are the way that
that's
how they communicate, and this is how they're spreading information.
In which case, they probably should have to listen to the constituents.
Exactly.
As long as they're, you know,
being respectful.
Not disorderly. Yeah.
Like look, if you could prove that you're putting the exact same information on a website and some other way where you don't have to have a Facebook account to access these things, then maybe that's a little bit different too. But in many cases, I would gather, especially with the school board, this is probably the primary place where they are disseminating information.
What do you think, Shoshana?
It's interesting because I usually fall down on criticizing government. That's usually my a little bit go-to. And this is an area where it's a little bit confusing because I think like a lot of what we're arguing here is within First Amendment context. So if you're applying the First Amendment to them, cursing, harassing within certain limits would all be allowed.
Yeah.
And I'm sympathetic to wanting to make sure everyone has access to it. But I've also like worked with people running for office, and I've seen that guy replying over and over and over again. And just it makes it impossible for me to do my job for also to reply to other relevant people. And in office, like you get harassed constantly, but you don't have to answer every phone call that comes to the office. Most people who show up won't get to talk to the elected official. So for even making comparisons like that, I don't think it's quite the same. So I'm not sure I really buy the First Amendment arguments in certain cases here, but I understand where they're coming from. But I really do think that this is something where it's really hard to compare. And in my view, it also kind of comes down to like these are private platforms and kind of what you do within there is kind of your thing. Like if you're hosting an event for your campaign or even an elected official's event at like someone's house, the people at that house can kick people out. You can probably kick people out a little bit easier, even just for swearing. Like if a guy stands up and swears a bunch, like I don't think anyone would take issue with kicking him out. But if he does that on Twitter, then we're kind of arguing that he has to stay because of the First Amendment. And I'm just not quite sure how I reconcile a lot of that.
To expand that idea, I mean, democracy is supposed to be a Norman Rockwell painting, right?
Yeah.
Where somebody who, you know, it's honest, hardworking citizens who read the newspapers show up and express their opinions, and then they sit down.
A.R. Geiger illustration, if you ask me.
Exactly, right, exactly. And what in fact happens on social media is some very undemocratic things like astroturfing, like disinformation campaigns, like bots that spread all kinds of information, lying, all kinds of things that don't really fit that Norman Rockwell painting. And so I'm not saying that this is in fact the kinds of accounts that are being blocked, but I'm just saying that the space is not, it's not a town hall.
No.
We'd like to say that it is, but it isn't.
It's as Justice Roberts said, a gathering of the protons. And I think we should all remember
going
that.
Through tubes. It's all the protons going through the series of tubes.
Yes.
I think he must have known that was kind of a silly thing.
Oh, I'm
to
sure
say.
He did. He's,
but,
yeah.
It's pretty funny.
It is very funny. It's a great quote.
take a little break. We're getting long in the tooth here. I don't want to keep you all too long. But you do have a few stories to wrap up with. Great panel, Mike Elgin. Love having you. How's Kevin's Chatterbox? Hello, Chatterbox.com. How's that doing these days?
He's killing it. He's really making headway into schools. He just landed some major school districts, and I think
Massachusetts, they're adding ChatGPT to it. That's very cool.
Yep.
Nice.
Yep. Well, what's happening is in the culture is that there's a ton of awareness about AI and how do we prepare kids for AI, and it turns out that Kevin's Chatterbox is the only chat virtual assistant that's legally allowed in schools.
Nice.
Because of its extreme privacy protections, where neither the sources of data that the virtual assistant uses nor Chatterbox itself can know who the user is. There's just literally no way to do that the way you set it up. And so it's the only legally allowable device of its kind in schools. And so schools are recognizing that, and he's doing very, very well with it.
The best thing from my point of view is it takes the magic out of AI and out of voice assistants, because the kids themselves write the software. So they see under the hood, they see what's really going on. And it's no longer this mysterious person in a box. It's just code.
That's right.
And I think that's so valuable.
One of the best Steve Jobs quotes is that his greatest epiphany in life is when he realized that all the amazing things in our world were created by people just like him.
Yeah.
Just like you and me.
Yeah.
And this is what Chatterbox teaches, that AI is not some magical, mystical, mysterious thing. It's just something that human beings create. And you learn that by actually creating AI. And so it's a really great tool for education.
Yeah.
And he's doing really well.
Hello, chatterbox.com. Yeah. By the way, Steve Jobs used that to explain why he broke every rule in the book and didn't have to follow
it. Yeah, never mind all that.
Rules, schmools.
Yeah, the world's created by rule breakers just like me.
Just like me. No. Those guys weren't any smarter than me. I'm going to do what I want. Christina Warren is also here. Great to have you. Senior developer. I like it when you come in. I really appreciate it. I'm glad you could share our snacks today.
Thank you for sharing your snacks.
Turn the heat up. Are you getting a little chilly?
No, I just wanted to show off
She's got the coolest jacket I've ever seen.
That's actually what I wanted to do.
I want a jacket that says ship it with a squirrel on the side. I don't know what that means,
yeah,
but I like it.
So this is a flight jacket, a GitHub flight jacket. And I have
this co-pilots. Is better than the flight jackets on Succession. This
Honestly,
is really good.
This is really good. See, all your base.
All your base are belong to us.
So that's actually...
That's really good.
Yeah.
So it's all like kind of Git jokes.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's just kind of internal things. And so I got this the other day.
Are they selling it at the event? Or?
They are not. This is just kind of a special thing that a few of us have.
Presenters only.
Yeah, basically. And so.
Is there anything on the back?
I don't think
so. Nope.
But what's cool is because it is a place jacket, I'm hoping that I can add other patches to it over time. So.
Pin exchange?
Pin exchange. Yeah, exactly.
Is there a GitHub challenge coin?
No.
Well, you got to get one of those. I think all podcasters should have challenge coins. And then when we meet, I should be able to demand a drink.
I like that.
Yeah.
I like that a lot.
Yeah. All right. We're working on it. Does our street have a challenge coin, Shoshana?
I've never heard of that. This might be a kind of nerd that Ferb wants I'm not.
You're every other kind of nerd. Everybody's Wikipediaing challenge coins. In the military, they carry these. Actually, it goes back to the Roman Empire.
Oh, nice.
I know we like to think about the Roman Empire frequently. Sure. If the Roman soldier excelled in battle, they'd get a day's wage with a separate bonus coin. These challenge coins are now typically carried by members of the service. And if you challenge somebody and say, where's your coin? And they don't have it, they have to buy you a drink. Otherwise, you can exchange coins. And I have quite a few challenge coins. Here's Joe Biden with his... challenge coin collection.
No, I think we should have podcaster challenge coins.
I think we should.
That would actually be really good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I want a challenge coin. I did buy at the White House gift shop, which in fact is not the White House gift shop. I learned later. just run by some guy, calls it the White House gift shop. He had, I bought, embarrassed to admit, a Trump challenge coin that said COVID defeated. I bought two, one for my father-in-law, who's a Trump fan, mm-hmm. and one for myself for historic purposes.
Of course.
And don't ask me for it, because I'm not. I'll buy you a drink. I'm not giving it to you. I wonder if you can still buy this on the, let me see.
I want one for, when I yell at the government and they get mad. They have to, give me a coin. It's that would be, I would have so many.
So let's see, there's 22 coins in the President Trump's Historic Moments series. This one's the acquittal of President Trump.
Okay.
Oh, here it is. Here it is. This is the world versus virus. No, this isn't the one I have. COVID-19 task force. No, that's sold. I guess they don't. Maybe mine is really valuable now.
Wow.
Yeah. Oh, no, wait a minute.
They're almost certainly more valuable than the Trump NFTs.
Yeah.
Yes.
Whatever happened to NFTs? Oh, you know what? The price went down. It's now, I bought it for $250. It's now only $100.
Okay. So, all right. You've lost, but that's all right. You still have the memories.
I knew I should have bought those Beanie Babies.
Are we still doing NFTs? Or are those gone? Are we not?
All right.
Is that over?
A good dear friend of mine, I won't name her name. She's been on our show many times. Got sucked into the cryptocurrency NFT void and was really promoting and stuff. Just the other day, she said, women, it's good for you to get into crypto and NFTs. And I'm thinking, should I post on here? No, don't. There's the only people who say this are people who got in early and are trying to get out now. Do not buy another NFT because you're throwing your money away. But so there's still people trying to promote these. And I think it's mostly people
who are holding the bag. Yeah. Yeah. You, people who got in at the very end of the pyramid.
Yeah.
Like you are like, the bottom.
I don't want to be stuck with this thing.
Yep.
Have NFTs like been like used for anything? Like have they
the only,
like, done
there's
anything,
a, yes, you know? There's a one good thing that I will say is okay, which is artists. It's basically a donation to the artist.
Yeah.
Right. They would sell some of their artistic work. We have, there was a wonderful artist. She did the Fail Whale. I can't remember.
Yes. Yes. Wonderful. Yes.
And I have, she gave me a copy of the Fail Whale that she drew that Twitter eventually used. You know, the whale being carried by birds as it sleeps. It's a beautiful thing.
Yi-Ying Lu.
Yeah, Yi-Ying. She won't sell it anymore. You only can buy it as an NFT. And I don't, that's not, to me, satisfying. So I think artists should sell their wares. That's probably the best way to do it. But if it supports, you know, arts, I think that's okay. As long as you understand it's not an investment.
Right.
That's the mistake to think I'm going to make money on this.
Or that it was an article.
Yeah.
Right. A month and a half ago, I think, in The Guardian, that pointed out that the vast majority of NFTs are now worthless. And something like 23 million people now have completely worthless investments. And so that, like, this is the vast majority.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Except you don't even have anything physical. Like, at least there you had, you know, some cloth and, you know, filled with some beans and some stuffing, right? So you had physical object. It's worthless, but you have a physical object. With NFTs, you have a URL, which may or may not even be active right now, right? Like, not only are many of them worthless, many
of
them are offline.
Right.
That's it, you know, so.
The big, eventually NFTs kind of narrowed down to one company, OpenSea.
Mm-hmm.
The big NFT marketplace, they just announced 50% of their staff is being laid off. This is where you would buy Bored Apes and Pudgy Penguins, kids.
Yep.
This is very much reminds me of the Beanie Baby thing.
It's very, very similar. Although what was weird there, I mean, there's a great book and I think
there's a wonderful movie.
The movie was just based on the book about that. Kind of that bubble. But that was weirdly largely kind of built by the value was hyped up by many of the collectors themselves, whereas NFTs, like the market maker was usually not the collectors, but these, you know, outsiders who were trying to tell us all and convince us all that this was a great investment in the future of art.
So Friday they said we're going to fire 50% of OpenSea's staff. However, there's some good news. They're preparing to launch the revamped OpenSea 2.0. according to... CEO Devin Finzer, we're building a new foundation so we can innovate faster and we'll have experiences to share with you soon. He said this on Where Else X.
Of course.
We will change how we operate, shifting to a smaller team with a direct connection to users. Now, when you say 50%, that sounds like a big thing, but remember, they'd already laid off 20% of their staff last year. So it's kind of unclear how many people are left. It's around 120, something like that. I'm surprised there's still that many people.
Same, to be honest with you. And you never like to see layoffs happening anywhere. I'm also surprised they still were employing that many people.
Oh well, I'm going to have to just put those Bored Apes up on the wall and live with the fact that I supported. That's the sad thing. The person who drew the Bored Apes didn't get that money.
No.
He got a few $100. And the people who sold the Bored Apes as digital artworks made billions, millions anyway.
Well, the very, very early people who did.
Right.
Right. Like, so it depends,
the creators.
How close to the top of the pyramid were you when the, you
Well,
know,
and towards the end, it was really OpenSea that was making the money with gas fees because it costs us a lot to mint an NFT and then to sell it again. And those money.
There's also a difference between somebody who at some point had NFTs of a very high value.
Right.
That value could only be realized if they liquidized that and converted that into cash by selling it and then getting out of the market. But I think the hype was so great that people who were succeeding plowed those investments into still more NFTs. And so I would be curious to, somebody ought to do a report. Somebody other than myself should write a investigative report to find out who actually walked away from this whole thing with any sort of profits or revenue or value.
Well,
bet that monkey itself is very rich. Like that monkey's got to be rolling.
Yeah, he's not bored. He's a wealthy ape in his yacht. Bitcoin is $35,000.
Wow.
I know. What's the story there? Is Bitcoin back?
I mean, that is still way down from what wasn't it 50K like in 2021?
Let's see. The peak was $61,000 in 2021.
Okay. That was like April, I want to say.
November 12th, 2021.
Oh, wow. My birthday. Okay, cool.
Happy birthday. I hope somebody gave you a Bitcoin for your birthday.
Well, if they had, I hope I sold it on my birthday and not like now.
That's the trick.
You know, that is the trick. So
wait a minute. Happy birthday.
Thank you.
It's coming up.
Yes.
Are you going to do anything fun?
I will be just getting back home after being here. So I don't know. We'll see.
I will be mine's November 29th.
Nice.
I will be shaking because I haven't touched electronics in 4 days.
Yes, that's true. So, oh my gosh. No, so you're doing this on your birthday week.
On my birthday.
Wow.
Yeah. No cake for me. But it is going up. I mean, Bitcoin is going up
yes,
a little
it is.
Bit. Yeah.
I was going to say, last time I think it was at 26 or 27, yeah. But still way down.
Should I go out and buy some?
I'm the wrong person to ask on this because I always make the wrong decisions on these things. I bought a bunch of Doge. And I didn't sell it because my sister had just had her baby and it was literally like the peak time to sell it and I didn't. And then I was like, oh, well, I'll just wait a little bit longer and it just keeps going lower and lower and lower. And so, but I bought Doge in like January of 2021. So,
oh, that's good.
You know.
When Father Robert, our Jesuit priest who used to do a show for us, got in very early on Doge and sold it for, I think, a peak.
Good. Good for Father Robert.
He said he made some money on it, yeah?
Well, it didn't cost us anything.
It didn't cost us anything, so I guess you could sell it. Any sucker, I mean, anybody who could buy it would make you some. Bitcoin has risen 10,000% over its initial price.
I mean, you have obviously the much worse Bitcoin like story of loss.
I have 7 or 8 Bitcoin just sitting there waiting.
Yeah.
You know, the real story, and I'm waiting to see if this happens, is that a number of people who put their Bitcoin wallets passwords in LastPass have now been hacked.
Of course.
We don't have proof that it's because of the LastPass vault breach, but it seems to be that all of the people who have lost money had LastPass, were using LastPass. In one day this past week, $4.4 million. CoinDesk says LastPass hack victims lose $4.4 million in a single day. The total is now $35 million. They can't prove that it's because of the LastPass vault hack, but since all of these people share that one thing in common.
It definitely seems something to investigate more. Gosh, that. I'm a little surprised LastPass is still in business. Like I know that they have other products too, but to have that type of breach and still I don't know how you come back from that, to be completely honest. Yeah.
Well, and if you do have your wallet and its password in LastPass, you might want to think about changing.
Yeah, I would say so.
I mean, let's assume they already have it. So you might want to transfer it to a different wallet, change the password, you know what to do. Meanwhile, if the bad guys who have the LastPass vault can get into my, I'll split it with you.
Oh, well, okay. I was going to say, now there is a YouTuber who's like a security expert who's been able to break into those guys. Have you talked to him?
No, I'm not going to do it. So look, let's say it's 7.85 Bitcoin, $35,000. It's like $250,000.
Right.
If I give him the wallet, he could just take it.
No, he's like an actual reputable security expert, and he documents these things, and he might take like 50K or something. Like that might be what.
But what's
he could
my recourse
you.
If he takes the whole thing?
I mean, you're Leo Laporte.
I could yell at him.
I'm just saying, like that would go against his own companies and interests if he were to do that.
My son wanted me to send it to some guy he saw in the Wall Street Journal named, I think, Bitcoin Larry or something. Claimed the same thing. The problem is mine's in the Bitcoin Core wallet, which had strong encryption. I have no clue what the password is. A lot of these guys say, well, can you give me, the area which the password would be or something? I have no idea, and I did not. I wish I had now. Then somebody'd have access to it, put it in LastPass. If I had, I would have found it. I don't know where it is. So, well, if Bitcoin Larry gives, find the name of this guy.
I'm going to find the name of this guy because I watched his stuff and it was, he was really, really good.
Yeah, that's, you know, nobody ever lied on YouTube. Right?
You're as sarcastic as Elon's AI.
Let's see, Wall Street Journal. I'm trying to find my guy. See if my guy's the same.
I think this is
Dave Bitcoin was
okay.
His name.
Joe Grand is, I'm pretty sure.
Okay. Not Dave Bitcoin. Okay. Dave Bitcoin said he could do it. But Dave Bitcoin was the pseudonym of a number of different hackers who would get together. You send them your wallet, they send you back what they can get out of it minus a small commission.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm trying to find the guy that I found this through. It might have been, I think it was Joe Grand, but basically, he was successful. I mean,
how much did he charge? Because Dave only charges 20%.
I don't remember now, but I do remember it was.
I think I gave my wallet to my son. I said, send it to Dave. see what Dave can do. This is the only trusted service since 2013 for your crypto. All right. I don't know. You know what? It's worth it. Look, I don't have access to it now. I've tried every password it could possibly be. You give me the name of your YouTube guy. And if I lose everything, I'm no worse off, right?
He might
have a little better.
If it's the guy I'm thinking of, I think like he was like a well-known hacker in.
I think it's still, you know, it's strong encryption. Yeah, I gave Flo the wallet, but she never did anything with it. So I'm taking it back. All right. Our show today brought to you by Collide. Let's talk Okta. Use Okta. You know Okta. Okta is a great solution. But Collide takes Okta one better. It's a device trust solution for companies that use Okta that ensures that if a device isn't trusted and secure, it can't log in to your cloud apps. Why is it important? Well, if you work in security or IT and you're using Okta for authentication, this message is for you. Sure, you can authenticate the person. The problem has been, this was, by the way, the problem with the LastPass breach. The person's the person, but is their device secure? In the case of the LastPass breach, the engineer, this DevOps guy, had a old version of Plex on his home network that had been hacked. They got into his system and they were able then to get into LastPass through that. Mm-hmm. That's a big problem. Have you noticed for the past few years, the majority of data breaches and hacks you read about have one thing in common: employees. Sometimes an employee's device gets hacked because of an unpatched program on the system or the network. Sometimes an employee leaves sensitive data in an unsecured place. And it seems like every day a hacker breaks in using credentials they've fished from employees. Boy, if you're in business, you know you're getting spearfished all the time. But the problem isn't the end users. It's the solutions you're using that are supposed to prevent those breaches. They're not, are they? It doesn't have to be this way. I want you to imagine a world where only secure devices can access your cloud apps. In this world, those fished credentials, useless to hackers. And you can manage every OS, including Linux, all from a single dashboard. Imagine if this DevOps guy had gotten a message saying, hey, I know it's you, Dave, but can you fix that Plex because I'm worried about your system? And then they fix it, and Dave's now part of your team. You want your employees to be on your side. Well, here's the good news. You don't have to imagine this world. You can just start using Collide. Collide. Visit collide.com/twit. Book an on-demand demo today. See how it will work for you. For teams that use Okta, this is a must. Collide. Collide.com/twit. We thank them so much for their support of This Week in Tech. We'll be back with the show in just a little bit. Don't forget, tomorrow, 10 a.m., Monday, that would be November 4th, 5th, 6th? November 6th, OpenAI Developer Days are tomorrow, and there's a big keynote at 10 a.m. And as part of our AI show that Jeff Jarvis and Jason Howell do, we'll be covering that live keynote on the stream. If you want to watch it, 10 a.m. Pacific, tomorrow, Monday, the 6th. Just want to throw in that show note. We had a great week this week in Twit. In fact, such a good week, I decided to commission this very special movie all about it. Watch.
Michelangelo did weapon systems, too.
Yeah, we're a bloodthirsty lot. I feel like every technology that we come up with, the very first thing is, well, can I kill somebody with this? And I think that's what's going to happen with AI.
His signature weapons were a single and dual nunchaka.
Wait a minute. Cartoon. Michelangelo? You're talking about the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle.
That is the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle. I know.
Previously on Twit. Twit News.
The new MacBook Pro is scary fast. And with M3 Pro and M3 Max, there's a perfect model for everyone.
When they first shipped the M1 and the M2, they held off on the Pro and the Max for later. They're doing an M3, an M3 Pro, and M3 Max all today.
I really wish that I had talked to the technical directors and producers ahead of this so I could have had them play back the number of times Leo said, I'm not going to buy a Mac. I'm not going to buy a Mac.
Tech News Weekly.
President Biden issued a pretty big executive order on artificial intelligence. It aims to address many of the risks.
I don't think the AI EO contemplates solving all of these problems. What it does address is, let's get our hands around the scope of the problem, and from there, we can work with the companies to figure out specific solutions.
This Week in Google.
Leo, instead of this cruise crap,
yeah, I'll come on a train.
The Twit train.
Woot, woot. Choo-choo.
I'm all in. We're going to have to get a lot more members in Club Twit.
Subscribe to Club Twit so that we can podcast
so we can
from a
go
train.
Your $7 a month would allow us to do this show on a train.
Twit.
All aboard, ride the Twit train rails.
And toot, toot, toot.
Oh, God. This Week in Tech, AI has won in court. We'll stick with court for a few more stories. Artists have lost the first round of the copyright infringement case against AI art generators. This happened at the end of the month. A federal judge advanced an infringement claim against Stability AI, but dismissed the rest of the lawsuit. He said, you can't sue Midjourney or DeviantArt. Among the issues, whether the AI systems they run on actually contain copyrighted images. And if the artist can prove it, can substantiate infringement in the absence of identical material, right? If you didn't create Picasso's Guernica pixel for pixel, can you prove that Guernica exists in the AI's corpus? Claims against the companies for infringement, right of publicity, unfair competition, breach of contract, dismissed. The claim for direct infringement against Stability AI was allowed to proceed based on allegations the company used copyrighted images without permission. So there's two issues. One, if you're stealing images, they're copyrighted images and you're stealing them, versus if you're going through the internet and looking for open images, uncopyrighted images. The suit maintains that training the Stability AI model does not include wholesale copying of works, but rather involves development of parameters, lines, colors, shades, and other attributes associated with subjects and concepts from those works that collectively define what things look like. I'm not sure what this all means. This is the Hollywood Reporter talking about it. I don't know if that's a clear win for, to be honest, for AI. I think in the long
run,
it's
better than a clear loss.
Yeah,
I mean, it's
right.
And it is interesting. It drives home the intractable nature of this whole conflict, because you have, you know, if you're a physical artist and you're influenced by another artist, which 100% of artists are,
yes,
then is that copyright infringement? And if
yes,
software does it, then what's the difference? And all, et cetera, et cetera. And again, how do you track down a one-for-one, here's a copy, when you're talking about vagaries like style and shades of color and things like
that?
You
can't copyright that.
No.
Because
yeah,
every artist is building their
correct
style on top of styles they've
correct
seen before.
And I mean, in fact, I think it's really problematic if we go down that line and we say, if anybody were to draw anything inspired by or in the style of, which happens all the time, then there's a lot of art that is, it would be, I think most rational people would consider to be fair use, would go away, right? And that's, so
I remember seeing a amazing exhibition of Picasso's early sketches, which are all copies of well-known paintings
of
and
course
art. I mean, that's Toulouse-Lautrec, baby. But how does Picasso become Picasso? by copying other
by learning
people.
I mean, that's what we all
and
do.
And then developing his own style.
Correct.
Wait, I'd like to push back on that a little bit.
Okay.
Because like artists will take specific art. They don't take all the corpus of all art.
Sure they do. Art.
No,
that's
no, no,
Benito
no.
Gonzalez
so
talking our TD.
They
but wait, no. Don't you think Picasso wandered through the Louvre and looked at every single painting and absorbed
a bunch
it? Well, but he absorbed what he was seeing,
yes,
right?
But he still had, like, he was still selecting.
Okay, but why should that matter? I mean, I understand that
because a person can't look at every every book in existence.
Well, of course, obviously, and that is why we can do more things more quickly with AI. But the principle I think is the same, that you can read that we are taking things from learning, whether it's from reading styles or looking at artwork or
every
listening to
great
music.
Writer reads yes. like crazy.
Yes,
there's no great writer who hasn't read a million books.
I mean, and I guess
and I'm also.
Just, to me, I understand what you're saying, but to me, it feels like if the only thing we're separating here is the amount of scale, then that just fundamentally we're still talking about the same thing. So whether it's one piece of art or a billion, I don't think the fundamental thing matters personally. But that's me.
Right. And to Jerome Lanier's point about AI being a massive collaboration at scale, even though nobody can read every book, Picasso is being influenced by all these artists who themselves were influenced by a bunch of artists.
And all the way
down. Were influenced and so on. And that starts to approach what generative AI does. And The Verge actually had a great list of reasons from different companies, because all the different companies have different reasons why they should not have to pay for copyrighted content.
Mm-hmm.
So Google says that it's like reading a book. Anthropic says that the current law is sufficient for protecting copyrighted works. Adobe says addresses the case of Sega versus Accolade, where intermediate copying was deemed fair use. Andreessen Horowitz says that investment in AI technologies based on the current copyright law. That's already happening. Hugging Face says that training on copyrighted material is generally fair use, and so on and so on. It's a great
this
article,
is
actually.
Wes Davis and writing in The Verge. Now, I think his point is more against these companies.
Yes, it is. But I still think
he says AI companies have all kinds of arguments against paying for copyrighted content.
Yes.
Meta says copyright holders, you wouldn't get much money anyway.
Yeah.
Which is true.
It's really interesting. Yeah. It is interesting to think about, though, and like, a lot of these companies are still trying to stop it from happening in one way or another. Like my photos that I take on my phone that are up to Adobe standards, right. I upload to Adobe Stock. And now every single time I upload, it says, make sure this, if it's AI, follow these rules. And it's like, they're really trying to like kind of avoid, like one of their things is saying, like, don't have the artist's name in it. If you're trying to like copy an artist, that shouldn't be in there. But it's really interesting, like, how even while these companies want to train models, they still want to have their own limits on the output, which is really interesting. But I struggle with this too, because it's like, you know, when like knowing exactly how and when it crosses the line is hard. And copyright and trademarks have always been, I think, to a degree, a very blunt tool for art in general. And I'm not sure how that evolves going forward, because we're not going to just stop AI from like learning people's styles.
To bring back Judge Alsop, that was his decision.
Yeah,
was that you can't copyright an API.
Right.
And thank goodness he decided that, because otherwise you've got real problems. If I can't reverse engineer your API so that I can make something compatible, that's going to really shut down a lot of software development.
And I think that's what my biggest like fear is for a lot of people who want to take this to the immediate, well, of course they should have to pay and all of this is copyright and whatnot, is that for the last 20 some odd years we've been fighting to try to loosen and make more clear the rules around fair use. Because I think that most people, especially small creators, understand why transforming content and being able to remix content is an important thing to do. This to me feels like, and even though I understand why some artists are very much pushing back against this thing, it feels like very much a step back against that. Because the people who I genuinely think will be hurt the most are not the big artists and the big places who have money to fight these things, but are small people who might eventually, like, okay, well, what happens if you want to use these tools in a creative way, right, but now you're being told that you are violating some sort of copyright and that you can't create this? That to me seems much more harmful than the fact that, yes, I can tell an image generator to create something in the style of this work, which is, let's be completely honest, right now, I know this will change, but right now will not be perfect. We'll have many discrepancies and things that will require edits or other changes, which to me means that you're further editing and building on top of these things. I think that we lose out when we're pushing against these ideas of opening things up to being transformed, just because we don't like the people who are doing it.
Benito, do you think artists, and Benito is musician, do you think artists should be protected against AI incorporating their art into the large language models?
That's a bigger question I don't have an answer to. I mean, I don't know. I don't make any music off my art anyway. I don't make any money off my art anyway. So, right, like, whatever.
But let's say you're Thomas Kincaid, painter of light. And I can go into Stability AI or Midjourney and say, I want a painting in the style of Thomas Kincaid. And it's going to look a lot like Thomas Kincaid painted it. Thomas Kincaid's passed, but does the estate of Thomas Kincaid have a action against Midjourney because I can say that and get something that looks like his paintings? The only way it would know is if it had seen a lot of his paintings, just as the only way we would know if you were making house music, Benito, is if you'd heard a lot of house music.
I think the better question to ask is, do you sue the AI, or do you sue the person who made the prompt, who prompted the AI to do that?
And I think then it would probably come down to how similar it is. Now, if you're literally using something to try to make a facsimile, then I think that's one thing.
Yeah, I mean, but there's laws against counterfeiting.
Yes, agreed. That's what I'm saying. So if it's truly a counterfeit, or if you're genuinely trying to pass it off as being by someone, I think that's one thing. But I think that in most cases, I mean, previous case law shows that, I mean, the Google Books trial being a good example of this, that the tools themselves are not the problem. If people want to use them to violate copyright. Then that's one thing. But I would even argue, at least right now, like if you enter in the same prompt into Midjourney or Stable Diffusion or DALL-E 3 or any of these things, you can enter the same prompt in 500 times and you will get 500 different results. It is not giving you the same result each time, which to me, because it's generative, which to me kind of goes against many of these arguments, regardless of what the corpus of it is. It's not as if it's giving you the same output each time.
There's also the problem of monetary value. At the end of the day, a painting is a product for sale. And the vast majority of paintings that painters paint are worthless monetarily.
Right.
They'll struggle to sell them at the market for, you know, at the flea market for, you know, $10 or whatever. And the same goes for generative AI art. If somebody's like Kincaid is a famous artist and making a great living with their art, I can generate, using a prompt specifying that person, and that AI art that I produce is worth nothing. Now, there's the argument where commercial artists who illustrate publications and so on may see a loss of revenue because publications may choose to use AI.
Sure.
And maybe even use the style of the people that used to create art for them by hand or whatever. But still, at the end of the day, AI generated art is not only there's way too many fingers on everybody's hands, but it's monetarily worthless. I mean, you can't, nobody's taking AI generated art to an art gallery and selling it for $50,000.
Even for photography, a lot of hikers have been like posting on Instagram about it, because all I follow on Instagram is hikers. But basically, some people are arguing, you know, you can't, if it's not the thing you saw, it's not going to be as valuable, even just for like following people, because I want to see what's this trail going to be like. Or I love Mount Sneffels. I want to see Mount Sneffels from a million different views. But if it's AI and it's not real, then I kind of don't care, because I want to know, like, oh, when's the best time to visit and stuff like that. I'm sure there's exceptions and times when even AI is going to create more valuable stuff in different cases. But I think it's like we kind of have to think about it from all those different angles. But it's hard in certain cases to understand from like, is this infringing on rights, and which players infringing on rights, you know?
I asked Midjourney to paint SpongeBob's house in the style of Thomas Kincaid. I don't think Thomas Kincaid has anything to worry about.
No, but that is cool.
I'll send it to you.
I love that. But yeah, you can make, I've actually been doing a lot of, with ChatGPT, making Hitchcock films about sloths and licensing reform and stuff like that. And like, once it can produce movies, I'm never leaving my apartment. Like, I'm just done.
Wow. I like that. Instead of the birds, it's the sloths.
It's the sloths. But you know what? I do actually believe, I fully believe that when we, because we will see AI art and AI music and other things being used in really innovative ways. But I firmly believe the people who will be doing those things are people who are already artists and are already musicians.
Yeah, there you go.
They are going to be using this as another tool to do things. But I look, are there going to be some individuals who will be able to Mike's point, bypass paying for stock photography or stock art? Yes, of course.
They already are.
And they already do things like that anyway. But if you want to find things that are truly going to have value monetarily or culturally or whatever, it is going to take humans who are going to take what they do well and things that these tools can help them do to create something that's you know, bigger than both.
I told you I would have a victory for Elon Musk before we wrapped up the show on Tuesday. Tesla won the first U.S. trial alleging that its autopilot killed one of its drivers. It's Tesla's second big win this year, in which juries have declined to find Tesla's full self-driving defective. The lawsuit was in Riverside County Superior Court. It alleged the autopilot system caused owner Micah Lee's Model 3 to suddenly veer off a highway at 65 miles an hour, strike a palm tree, and burst into flames. It killed Lee in 2019 and his two passengers. It was pretty gruesome. The plaintiffs asked for $400 million plus punitive damages. Tesla said, no, Lee had consumed alcohol before getting behind the wheel. It's also, and this is a problem because Tesla has software that will turn off autopilot the minute a crash is imminent. They asserted that it was unclear whether autopilot was engaged at the time of the crash. The jury said the vehicle did not have a manufacturing defect, voted 9-3 in favor of Tesla. But they did deliberate for 4 days, so it wasn't a slam dunk. Tesla said the jury's conclusion was the right one. So if there's any question, if you're in the driver's seat, oh, hell, forget that. If you're in the car, you're still liable for driving it, whether you let the car drive itself or not.
That's ridiculous. Okay, so why would anybody bother with this? Like, honestly, like, I get that the whole point was, you know, you don't have to worry about driving and whatnot. Well, now you're saying, oh, if I just happen to be in the car, then I'm liable, even though I didn't have
anything
to control.
Well, you have to be the, okay, but, okay. So what if you get out of the driver's seat? What if you get in the back seat? You're still liable, right?
The problem is that in the tiny print, in the legal mumbo jumbo, Tesla would tell you that it's not autopilot or full self-driving, and that you're responsible and keep your hands on the wheel and all that stuff. But in their marketing, they call
it
autopilot and full self-driving.
Yeah.
So the problem is the marketing and the it's typical of Elon Musk, the overhyping of his technology.
Brent Walker Smith, this is from the Reuters story, a USC professor of law, said the outcome in both cases show our juries are still really focused on the idea of a human in the driver's seat being where the buck stops.
I mean, I think a Tesla probably makes sense in those cases. I'd be interested to see what this would mean if you were talking about something like a Waymo or something else where it truly
is. Then you're not. If you get an autonomous taxi.
Right. Okay.
And there's no driver something happens, you never had control of that vehicle.
Right. I mean, and that's
not your responsibility.
Well, I mean, I would hope so. I guess we'll just have to see, because that's where my mind was going, thinking, okay, in this instance, obviously, yes, you have control. But if you were to take this to also apply to any form of autonomous driving, I would definitely look at the terms and services of those, you know, self-driving taxis very closely, because you definitely wouldn't want to be in a situation where you were, you know, responsible.
You guys are so smart. I'm going to bring all my difficult questions to you from now on. I want to thank you, Christina, for wearing purple nail polish like my purple jacket.
Yeah, matching.
I want to thank Shoshana for having purple hair like my purple jacket. I would like to know, Mike Elgin, what you've done for me lately.
Well, my glasses are almost purple. My Meta glasses, this kind of bluish.
Oh, there you go. I know what you've done for me lately. You and Christina talked me into buying those silly glasses.
I mean, I'm just saying, if you need sunglasses anyway.
Yeah, maybe I'll get them. Maybe I'll get them.
You should.
And then you go around and you take pictures. I have the Snapchat
spectacles. But again, those were ugly, and they the camera quality is now way better. So and they didn't have like a speakers in them.
Yeah, the speakers are what's interesting, isn't it?
It's the audio that's so good in these things.
Oh, I hate you. Mike Elgin.
Sorry.
It's great to see you. Gastronomad.net. If you want to go on those Gastronomad adventures, I cannot recommend them more highly.
Thank you. Evening
has fallen in Mexico City, where you did not have to suffer through the change of time. You've been at standard time this whole time. Mexico does not honor daylight saving time.
We went from 1 hour difference with California to 2 hours. So you guys change. We stay the same.
Yeah.
And so it's nice to not change the clock.
It's not so bad when the fall back, the gain an hour.
Yeah.
It's bad when you lose an hour.
It is, especially because they usually always time it during South by Southwest. Ugh. And so not only are you
hungover,
you've lost an hour and then you still have to be up early someplace. Yeah, it's the worst. Yeah.
Well, we have until March to change this long national nightmare. I beg of you. Actually, the only thing Congress has done is to say we should stay on daylight time.
Yeah.
I guess I don't care. Just stay on something.
Something.
It doesn't matter. Just an arbitrary number that we're applying to the
much,
time of day.
It's how much light you have in the morning versus how much you have at night.
Yeah, it's for the farmers.
It isn't. The farmers hate it. You know what? Cows don't know. They haven't been told.
You can be Marky Mark and go to bed at 7:30, or you can stay up till 1. It's just arbitrary.
It's up to you, baby. Thank you, Mike Elgin. Hello, chatterbox.com. Don't forget Kevin's wonderful project that every school.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Every single classroom. Christina Warren, have a wonderful GitHub universe.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. And anybody who wants to join us online for free, githubuniverse.com on Wednesday and Thursday.
So exciting. And you're doing great work there at GitHub.
Having a great time.
I'm just so thrilled. And let's not forget Rocket at relay.fm, because you and Simone de Rochefort and Brianna Wu, who will be on next week.
Yeah.
They said, shouldn't we do another takeover? And I said, not if Simone's going to ask me tough questions again. Like last time, but I failed that quiz, although I've since watched RRR.
Good.
So I know next time, but she won't ask that question again. Now she'll have some other obscure movie. Relay.fm/rocket.
Thank you so much.
Great show. Shoshana, when are you going to have an R Street podcast? You would be great on that.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, we had a short running one. It's just a lot of resources and it's good. We like podcasts, but so much of what we want to get to people, we can do very simply through email and LinkedIn and sometimes Twitter to the degree it exists now. So we might do some more of it. And it went pretty well, but LinkedIn has higher ROI and so does email for us.
Yeah. And what the stuff you do, the deep policy stuff you do, really deserves to be written out.
Thank you. I love my job.
Yeah, I think it really deserves that that kind of attention and detail. But it's good to know you're on LinkedIn. So what is the LinkedIn account?
Yeah, I forget exactly the handle, but it's just R Street Institute on LinkedIn, and we want people to follow us. My direct report handles our LinkedIn, and she's really good at it.
Yeah, good. So look for R Street Institute at LinkedIn. Another fine Microsoft company. Glad we could plug everybody.
Yeah,
and of course, Senator Shoshana on the X, where she's in charge of Sloth Outreach or Blue Sky. Actually, from now on, I should ask people, Blue Sky, that's the one you want to be seen on? You think, Shoshana?
I don't know. I'm trying to do more there. It's just figuring out where people are.
Yeah.
It's definitely secondary to Twitter for us, but it's something that I want to keep doing a little more of because there are people relevant to us there.
And it is Senator Shoshana .bluesky
dot
social, or BSKY, as they say, dot social. There she is, Sloth Committee Chairman. Where are you hiking next?
It's going to be a while, but I have 6 weeks planned out. My friend's actually getting married in Hawaii, so I'm getting there 2 weeks early to hike.
There's some beautiful hikes in Hawaii. Hawaii is a wonderful place to hike.
I can't wait.
Oh,
I'm going to miss the marmots, though, you know?
Okay, should I follow up on that, kids, or should I just let that lie?
I mean, I think we have to follow up.
What marmots?
Marmots.
There's marmots
that I wish. No, at elevation, there's a lot of marmots.
Oh, okay.
In Hawaii, there's no marmots.
No marmots.
Know?
I do love marmots. I must say, I share your interest in marmots. Thank you, Christina. Thank you, Shoshana. Thank you, Mike. Thanks to all of you for joining us. We do This Week in Tech every Sunday evening. Right after Ask the Tech Guys, it is 2 p.m. Pacific, 5 p.m. Eastern, 2200 UTC. Now that we are back on standard time, 2200 UTC. You can watch us do it live at live.twit.tv. Chat with us live at irc.twit.tv. Of course, if you're a Club Twit member, you have access beyond the velvet rope. I mean, you can live in the SpongeBob SquarePants houses.
Yeah.
if you want. I don't see Kincaid in these, to be honest. But anyway, Discord, you get free ad-free versions of the shows. You get all the extra shows we do, twit.tv/clubtwit, if you're not already a member. After the fact, we do have ad-supported on-demand versions of our shows available at the website, twit.tv. You can also go to a YouTube channel dedicated to This Week in Tech. It's a good way to share clips because you can just take a little clip and share those out. If you have a little portion of the show you want to share with friends, we'd appreciate that. Of course, the best way to get the show is subscribe in your favorite podcast player. That way you'll get it the minute it's available. Thank you all for being here. We'll see you next time. Have a great week. Another twit is in the can. Bye-bye.